in Fayette County. It's about 50 miles east of Charleston. We're in a very rural area. And so that's a lot of the things you were describing are realities that we have already known. Right, exactly. And a little bit of off-mic conversation there. I was just telling her a little bit about our experience there in West Virginia and the fun things that happen when insurance companies, for instance, pay for property damage to 136,000-mile pickup trucks and how you get too rich. And hopefully that all goes away. So They were going great guns keeping the guests running in here. We are expecting to hear from Sarah Summer in about a minute's time, and hopefully she will be along. And given the hour, it's kind of a shame that I'm broadcasting in this slot. You know, I could have done 9 to noon or whatever, but. Stand by. No, what I was saying is, given the hour, they are the weirdos will be starting their march real soon. And like I said, I try to feel some degree of sympathy or look at them as my fellow countrymen, and then it all just sort of goes to hell when I see their stupid signs. Okay, we're back. Since we're sort of doing this on the fly and figuring things out as we go, that sort of thing becomes a bit of a necessity. But we've got someone behind the microphone right now who is reporting from the front lines. Horn intern reporter Ferg is with us.
Hello.
Hi, Ferg.
Hi.
You've been outside. Did you go outside and play with the weirdos?
I went outside and played with the weirdos. At first, I kept my distance because a lot of people were coming through with defund Planned Parenthood, and the Canadian Snapple guy is there.
Have we figured out the Canadian Snapple guy?
I actually went up and asked.
Was it worse than what we thought? Okay. So let's do a little setup on this real quick. Yesterday, I took a photograph. I took a photograph yesterday. I want to get this right because you don't just find this every day.
No, you don't.
Of dude standing in front of the Supreme Court with a sign that reads as follows. Canada. Okay, anybody who's ever sat through, say, Logic 101 knows what a syllogism is. And here's what the sign says. Canada has national health care. It has a short growing season and cannot grow much food. At that point, I just felt like a not a well man, because it might as well have said to us, Brillig and the slithy toes, the gyre and gimble in the wave, and all mimsy were the boar groves and the mome rats outgraved. Canada has national health care, it has a short growing season, and cannot grow much food. So you talked to short growing season dude. Ferg calls him Snapple dude because his sign sounded like something under a Snapple cap.
It was just a quick trivia fact. Even if you can't learn much from the teabaggers, you still learn something. And I did.
You can call that learning.
I did indeed talk to him, and I don't know really how to word it the way he had. So I'm going to take.
Whose side was he on? Because that wasn't clear. Whose side?
He's on the anti-Obamacare side.
Well, of course he is.
I'm going to try and speak a little more. I'm going to try to clarify it for the audience. What he had said to me was, what it means is, since Canada has health care, why should we? He doesn't like Canada. And that.
No, wait.
That's exactly what he said.
No, this is a dude out of South Park. This is like something with Terrence and Philip.
Yes, indeed it was. But what was funny is I asked him after he told me, I don't like Canada. I like protesting. I asked clearly and calmly and rationally, then what does having to grow crops do with this? And he said, well, I just thought that America needed to know Canada's not all that great. And I was stunned. Yes, Dad, beat your head against the mic. It's after that, I decided, I said, well, good day to you, sir. I love Canada. And walked away.
God be with you, eh?
And I also watched them come up from where we had seen them, down, you know, Senate Parkway. And they were all coming up. They have their flags flying, you know, they don't tread on me.
Their Gadsden flags.
Yeah, their Gadsden flags. And
I've learned to despise that flag.
And they are all slowly but surely crowding into the...
Well, they're not moving real fast because they're not real young, are they?
You'd be surprised. I saw a few that looked that couldn't
be... We saw
a
right-wing teabag attack blonde earlier today.
Yes, but the way I saw it was that there are people there that can't be but a few years older than I. And that means that the apple hadn't
even
fallen.
Though they're not much older than you, they are atne ute aitre, if you one what I eme. Aitre?
Aitre. I'm proud to say that you're my father, even the times that you embarrass me in the supermarkets by dancing and singing, because you have given me something that obviously the right-wing ignoramus parents of those unfortunate adults had. You gave me a logical and rational mind, And for me to go out there and know the truth and be able to think outside the box and at least listen to their own opinions, Snapple Dude, for example.
Snapple Dude.
It's something special because listening to them, they babble.
You know, and that reminds me, I ran across, there was a person in a white lab coat claiming to be a real live, honest to Jesus, no kidding, physician. Who was hollering that Obamacare will make PSA tests for men. There will be no more PSA tests for your husbands or your brothers. No mammograms for your women folk. And again, claiming to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And I know better. I know better. I looked at her and said, are you saying that the Affordable Care Act makes PSA tests, prostate-specific antigens, something
yeah.
you'll learn about when you get older?
No, I already know. I dread the day.
That'll make that illegal? Well, no, it'll make it illegal for your doctor to order it. And I just looked at her and said, yeah, why? Why can't we... Why can't we have we can have a conversation, but you can't. We can't have a debate if you're lying about it. You've got to stop lying, madam, because right now you are a liar. I have read the bill. It's no. Prostate-specific antigen testing is not made illegal, nor are mammograms. Quit being a liar.
Well,
I just lost all patience.
Well, as hang on momentarily, folks. We're getting scheduling issues sorted out. I don't...
We're just trying to work out some scheduling details of who we're going to talk to when, and hopefully we're going to talk to Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland here in a couple of minutes. That's what happens during these things, folks. Schedules change, things like that, and what you thought was carved in stone suddenly becomes carved in silly putty. So that's kind of where we are right now. Now, you've got a note in here from Dr. John in New York, Ferg.
Yes.
Subject line, Snapple Guy. You are kidding me on that.
No.
Great spot reporting, Ferg. Oh, no, they're
it doesn't take much.
They're out there, and all you have to do is say hello, and they'll start telling you, did you know that Obama's a socialist?
One other great thing to Dr. John is the fact of when I was going through right after Snapple Dude, and... there was a woman that had a sign of abortion, and she said, and it said defund Planned Parenthood. And I asked her, why do you feel we need to defund Planned Parenthood? And she said, because Obamacare is going to take away the birth control and everything, and we don't want that happening. I said, actually, that's the complete opposite. You all are trying to take it away. Obamacare can give it. And, She started ranting on, getting a little upset.
Well, they do.
It's like playing with wasps. You leave them alone, and then when you go and you get near them, they
hop up, son. I think we've got a guest here.
All righty. Well, it was nice talking.
Oh, my pleasure, Ferg. So I'm really tickled here. When I was reading my bios to see who was coming to visit, I saw Spike Ford's name on my list, and I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, cool.
I read your LA Times piece, and was really, really, you know, the line about, you know, I'm a good person.
I'm a good person. I'm not a deadbeat.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm not a deadbeat. I'm not a loser.
Yeah, I don't drink wine out of a screw top bottle.
No.
Yeah.
I'm just an average old person.
So Spike Ward is with us. She is an artist and the creator of the cartoon strip Art. She's a painter. She's an educator. And I guess the thing that became transformative for you was you also became a cancer victim.
Yeah.
And everything went sideways then,
didn't
it?
That was never going to happen to me.
Yeah, bulletproof, right?
Yeah, no, that would never, never happen to me for all kinds of reasons. Yeah, I would never get cancer. Yeah, and
then you did.
Yeah, and the treatment for cancer is really creepy, and I'm not really cut out for this, but I got cancer, and I'm dealing with it. But, we were just living the American dream, my husband and I, both of us, are our own businesses. He's got a real small business. He fixes computers, and I started a nonprofit in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles to get the arts back into schools. And
yay.
Yay! And it's a wonderful cause.
I'm such an arts in schools nerd.
Yeah, you know, and we could talk about that on a whole other.
Yeah.
I mean, really, why that's important. But right before the recession hit, we were both doing really well with our businesses, and then boom, just all at once, you know, he kept working, and people weren't paying him, and then people quit giving to charity. But I had to keep my nonprofit going. So our insurance was $1,500 a month by then because I know that's how much our mortgage is in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But because we're entrepreneurs, we had to buy the most expensive insurance on the market and gives you the least amount of coverage as well. And it was just going up and up and up. And
you know, the insurance industry has a very specific word for folks in that position.
What is it?
They're called marks.
Yeah. Thank you. That's right. We're marks for them, and now we're marks for the people that want to say that we're deadbeats because we couldn't afford
right.
it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's like being caught in the crossfire.
It is. And that's the thing. Reason why I came to Washington, one of the reasons was I want people to know this is the face of the uninsured. You're looking at it.
Me too.
Yeah, okay.
Hi.
Yeah. If the face of the uninsured
sure.
is looks more and more like your next door neighbor, we just don't, we're not talking about it. So I wanted to out myself.
We're not Ernest T. Bass.
No, and we're not drug addicts that are, you know, just, anyway. So we're just the ordinary middle class L.A. people. We're doing really, really well on our own and had to use up the retirement and start dipping into our home equity line just to pay for our health insurance.
So what happened?
The bank cut us off. We had $200,000 in our equity line that we were counting on, and we were just going to do that till the recession was over. So, we were just going to ride it out.
Just ride the storm
out.
And
then the bank cut us off. So we had nothing. So we didn't have any savings. We burned through my husband's retirement, and now we can't even use the equity in our house. So what do we do?
What did you do?
So we can't do we can get through it without having to pay that $1,500 a month with the health insurance. So then we decided, okay, we're going to take this gamble. We'll get back on track as soon as we can.
So you made the choice, food versus insurance, and food won.
Thank you. And there are people out there that actually said we should have gone homeless, that we were irresponsible to choose the house over the insurance. Yeah. There are people that said that. I don't know why people... I don't know what makes people tick.
Everybody knows about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it's food, and it's shelter, and mm-hmm. it's water. You know, insurance isn't in there.
No.
And it shouldn't be. It should be something, frankly, that we don't have to think about.
Yeah, and writing that op-ed got a lot of worldwide attention. And
as well it should have.
Yeah, and it's countries that have, you know, we're the one developed nation that hasn't gotten this all taken care of. So the other, you know, there's other countries that have had nationalized health care for a while, and it works really well, and they don't want, you know, they defend their health care system.
I got to tell you a story real quick. That was my son who just walked away there, and I sent him out, yea, verily, among the heathen. And there's a guy out there who is anti-Obamacare, and he had this sign. Ferg calls it, my son's name's Ferg. He calls him the Snapple guy because he's got these signs that look like something you would read on the under the lid of a bottle of Snapple. And the one sign he has said, Canada has national health care and it has a short growing season and can't grow much crops. I was unwell when I saw it the first time, so Ferg decides to be boy investigative journalist and goes out and engages the guy in conversation, and he says, why? And the guy responds, well, I don't like this Obamacare, and I don't like Canada either.
Oh, poor guy, really.
But no, you said, you know, industrialized, civilized nations.
Yes.
Or what was the phrase you used, that most countries have...
Developed.
Developed, yes.
Yes, we're developed.
Right. Can we make an argument that the reason we haven't so far is that this developed nation has a few undeveloped people?
Undeveloped people and way too many people who make a lot of money off of health care.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of money.
You're in a battle with cancer, and
yeah.
Somewhere... There's a guy who has gold chains and chest hair and talks with his teeth clenched,
mm-hmm.
and says, babe, a lot, who's going to get a bonus because he managed to figure out a way not to pay out for your cancer coverage.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, isn't that the reality?
That's the reality. And were you here for the, you've been here all day, so you didn't get to hear the press conference.
No.
But there were seven women, unbelievable stories. Personal stories of how the Affordable Care Act is working for them right now. And my story is
literally... And it's working for you.
Yes, my life is being saved because of the Affordable Care Act.
You get to not be dead.
That's it. Bottom line, and or go bankrupt.
Right. I mean, I can't believe I'm sitting here talking like this with someone who is dealing with cancer, but you're dealing with it in a way that's incredibly humane. So, no, go ahead, please. Let me just answer this question.
Well,
I see what's going on.
Yeah.
No, do please. Just take a minute. Take a minute, please, to tell your story.
Okay, well, the story starts in the summertime. I find the lump myself, self-exam, routine exam. At women my age, we do this every month. I find it. I talk myself into it being a symptom of menopause because I don't have insurance. And I find what I'm looking for on the internet. It tells me I have something having to do with menopause. And then during a routine pap in October, the doctor feels it and says, that's got to come out right away. And then, boom, it was just it was a nightmare.
And you're at stage?
I'm stage three. So here I have no insurance. You know, you get told you have cancer, you think you're going to die. And... It's like someone tells you you're going to die. And then on top of that, the shock of being told that you're going to have cancer, now you have no health insurance. The reality of that, I have two kids.
Did you pick up Medicaid? Or?
I'm not poor enough. This is the other thing why I'm in Washington. Our tax return from last year shows that my husband made, you know, we by cashing in our retirement, they don't care where the money comes from. They don't look at that subjectively and say, that's too bad. They say, you're not poor enough for Medicaid. So there were no services for us. So it was PCIP, pre-existing condition insurance plan, through the Affordable Care.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what's saving my life.
Wow.
The Affordable Care Act.
We have got to continue this conversation.
Well, it'd be my pleasure.
No, these things happen way too fast, and the scheduling gets weird. Spike, no, seriously.
It's really nice talking to you.
When I get back into the home studio, we'll have a phone call or something
and
talk at greater length.
Okay,
I want to hear
pleasure.
More of this story.
Yeah,
it's
a common
badly.
Story.
It is.
It's
all
a real
too, all too
yeah.
common.
Yeah, wake up, America.
Indeed.
Okay,
thank you.
A lot.
Spike Ward.
Bye.
Bye now. And... Spike, the congressman was foreshortened because Representative John Sarbanes is going to drop by and speak with us for a couple of minutes here. Yeah, good to see you again. It's a pleasure. We last chatted in January.
Right.
And it's considerably nicer. Well, yeah, it's nice that it's not pouring down rain on all of this.
Exactly. No snow, no rain.
But obviously, you've continued your advocacy and your support for the Affordable Care Act. You're in the House of Representatives and you're dealing with a lot of crazy people.
Yeah.
What is your sense of? Let's be optimists and say that this is going to survive constitutional muster.
Yeah.
Constitutional muster.
Which I think it will.
Are they still going to? Even if the Supreme Court passes on it. Is the majority in the House still going to be jumping up and down and howling and spending a lot of time screaming about Obamacare?
No question. And they'll try, as long as they hold the gavel in the House, they'll use whatever means they have available to them to impede the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And that's why I think it's very important for those who advocate for the reform and believe that it's the right thing for the country to have, you know, to gain good representation in the next Congress so that we can maintain the implementation. And obviously, if the president's reelected, he'll be committed to that, but he needs a Congress that's working with him instead of against him in that effort. And so I'm hopeful that the sequence of events will be the Supreme Court concludes it's constitutional. We have an election in November that reelects the president and also makes sure that the Congress is in a place where it can support the president's efforts to implement this act.
Now, we're going to have a decision on this by June.
Right.
What kind of impact, either way, do you think that decision will have on the November election?
You know, I think it's hard to predict. It could be it's sort of a wash in terms of the dynamics that it generates. I mean, people tend to think that if it's struck down, that will hurt the Democrats and hurt the president. But it could cut the other way. It could mean that all the people that are worked up against it will sort of lose steam, and those who really wanted to see,
stay home.
Yeah, and those who really wanted to see this happen will be motivated to get out and vote for the president and for the Democrats who supported the bill. So I think it's really impossible to tell what the political fallout will be. I think as a practical matter in terms of maintaining momentum with implementation, and of course you have states like Maryland across the country that are trying to get in front of this thing and work well to be in a right position that
in terms of setting it up.
So as a practical matter, the effect of it being found constitutional will help those efforts move forward.
It is, as noted, frustrating for you to be dealing with the Congress, the House as it is presently constituted. You have to fight a lot of rear guard actions, obviously. What, assuming for a moment that we can't get the full sea change that we would like to have in the House, how do you go forward defending this act against efforts to water it down, weaken it, defund it? You know,
every day more people are benefiting from this law.
Sure.
Every day more young people are choosing to stay on their parents' health insurance and now can do that because of the Affordable Care Act. Every day there's a family out there who previously was looking at a child that had a pre-existing condition and realizing they couldn't get health insurance coverage, and now they can get it because that prohibition on the conduct of the insurance industry is in place. Every day seniors who were having to come out of pocket in a sizable way to cover the cost of their prescription drugs are seeing that out-of-pocket expense reduced because of efforts under this bill to close the donut hole. So what's happening is with each passing day, more Americans are benefiting from this reform, even now. And I think over time that will be the thing that makes this take hold and stay in place. And it'll help us make the argument, the political argument, that this was the right thing to do for the country.
What happens in states, for instance, that have significant Republican majority representation in the House? What happens on January the 1st, 2014, when suddenly they have a lot of constituents who now have, for instance, Medicaid eligibility? That changes the dynamic too, doesn't it?
No question about that. And of course, there's some states that have been very progressive in getting with the program on this. Maryland is one of them. There are others. And then you have states that have dragged their feet. Essentially, they're saying, we don't want to participate at all. Now, in those instances, HHS, the federal government, has the ability to come in and design health insurance exchanges, as it were, on their behalf. But obviously, it'd be better if they would cooperate. In terms of Medicaid expansion, you're absolutely right. Most states, if not all, are going to choose to accept that expansion because it means a lot to them in terms of resources, and in so doing,
and
they will be
asks them for no resources
exactly
matching funds, or
and they will be, and in so doing, they will be participating and joining in the benefits of this act. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy there if they continue to advocate against
that.
It. Yes,
exactly. Well, Congressman Sarbanes, I know you've been very, very busy today, and I want to thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks very much.
And thank you very much for your ongoing advocacy for this act and for all that it means for America's future.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland. All right, we're back, and these conversations, by definition, have to be kind of brief and on the fly. But I was really glad that Congressman Sarbanes could take a minute to have a discussion with us. It's about 15 past one. My next guest has not shown up yet, but let me take just a second here. I'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and I was just noting that the Robin of Locksley, the Duke of Nottingham, Duke Sachmo of Armstrong, whatever. You don't see that on your guest list a lot, but I have Aaron of Montana with me right now, with a real story of the effectiveness of the Affordable Care Act. And Aaron, welcome.
Thank you.
And why are you Aaron of Montana?
I'm not sure. That's how I'm identified on your list. I am from Montana.
Good, good. We've got a very dear friend in Helena.
Okay.
Living on the Front Range. That's how she signs all her emails. Lived on the Front Range.
I'm in the Arctic tundra.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah.
the frozen tundra.
Pretty much.
It hasn't been that frozen this year, though.
Oh, it has where I live.
Okay. So you're in serious Montana.
Yeah.
What brings you here today?
Well, I came today to tell my dad's story, Bill Ackley. He suffered through his insurance appeals process prior to the Affordable Care Act, and so he is a good example of problems that can be eliminated through the protections of the Affordable Care Act and their provisions for the appeals process.
And what was that process like?
To give you a little bit of background, he had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and that was managed through chemo for many, many years. And then it came to the point where he was accepted into a bone marrow transplant program. His insurance company paid for all of the preliminary steps leading up to the transplant. They paid for finding a donor, for the chemo to prepare his body for the transplant, and then when his doctor requested approval for the transplant, they denied it.
They said no.
Yes. They stated it was investigational, even though the transplant center had been doing it for years.
Right. Yeah. That's one of those things that the insurance companies love to plead, is that it's an experimental procedure, even though the experimentation ended 30, 40 years before. So they subjected your father to that. And, it's especially cruel when you send a person through all the front-end testing procedures, and where bone marrow transplants are concerned, that's rather extensive, isn't it?
It is. The chemo he had was particularly brutal because they essentially had to wipe out his whole system
in
order for it to be receptive for the donor cells.
And then you have no immunity from disease at all, right?
Correct.
And so you've got to be extra, extra careful not to be around anything or any germs. How did he deal with it? How did your family deal with it when
the
insurance company told him to, go away?
We pretty much we were shocked and we were lost at first. We didn't really know where to turn. There's a provision now in the Affordable Care Act where insurance companies have to inform patients of the consumer assistance program in their states now, and that would have been very helpful for us. So we went through the appeals process. The denial was upheld. My dad's doctor submitted a request for a full bone marrow transplant, thinking for sure it would be approved because they'd been doing it for 20 years. That was denied, so we appealed that. Eventually, the denial was overturned, but it took a period of 60 days, and during that time, my dad's cancer came back, and he was forced to go through an additional round of brutal chemo,
His
insurance paid for.
Well, yeah, right. Penny wise and pound foolish, right?
Right.
So, at some point, do you get to sue these people? I mean, make them pay for their cruelty, their brutality?
Well, we didn't go that route.
Well, I don't know if you could have. He went back on chemo. Did he go into remission again?
Well, he went through that additional round to keep his body ready for transplant, which he did. And the transplant occurred 126 days after the first request.
I've got to ask you, how did it go?
4.5 months after the transplant, he passed away. And he was 59 years old.
So sorry.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry. So, in essence, your father spent the last part of his life, instead of what I think we would all want, and that is to spend those days in some sort, you know, however it is that the person wants to spend it, but something resembling contemplative reflection, getting things done, getting things taken care of, wrapping up, doing bucket list things, right? Instead, he spent it
in a hospital.
In a hospital, fighting with an insurance company. I hope you'll forgive me when I say that. I hope there is an especially hot place in hell for the people who put him through that. I know that makes me sound like a real heathen, but I don't like insurance companies, and you've got reason not to like them. How do you look on this process now?
Well, I am hopeful that patients and their families won't have to go through the agony that we went through. I'm hopeful that insurance companies will be held accountable for their actions and will have to adhere to their time schedules that they say that they're going to give decisions in, and patients will know who they need to turn to for help. Hopefully, you know, this process, it's going to be better for them.
So your father's story stands as a cautionary tale for all of those people who would like to see the Affordable Care Act overturned. In other words, I think it is a direct reflection of the fact that these people don't understand what it is they're talking about wanting to go away. When these people stand out here and chant, hey, hey, ho, ho, Obamacare has got to go, what they're saying is that they want this to happen. They want what happened to your dad to happen to lots more people. Isn't that, I mean, that's basically the essence of it, isn't it?
I'm not sure they're thinking of that.
Oh, well, that's exactly, well, no, thinking is what they're not doing. They're not very good at the thinking thing. But that is, and you, having lived through it with your father, would not wish that on your worst enemy, would you?
Of course I would not. And I have a young child who I want to have, you know, health care and protections as well throughout her life.
Certainly.
So I have a lot invested in this. Everyone does. Everyone needs health care.
Well, you and I, there's a lot of distance between West Virginia and Montana, but there's a lot of similarities in the people. A lot of rural communities, a lot of fiercely independent, you know, pull myself up by my own bootstraps kind of thinking. Have you told your story back at home? And if you have, what kind of responses do you get?
I'm fortunate. I've lived in many different communities in Montana, and I have friends in all those communities, and they're very supportive of me. And a lot of those friends came to my dad's aid by writing letters to our officials and tried to support him in any way they could. So it's the people that I have interactions with as a family, and my community is a great community, too.
Wonderful.
I love Montana.
As well you should. I applaud you for not just tearing at your hair and running through the crowd screaming, because, frankly, I probably would in your circumstance. Mm-hmm. You bring real humanity to the story. And I would not blame you one iota if every other word you used to describe that insurance company had been something you can't say on the radio, and our entire conversation was just a syllable and a beep. I would understand. But you don't do that, and you bring real poise and real grace and real humanity to this discussion. And I wish you the best, and I hope you... have you gotten to talk to a lot of folks here in the Radio Row today?
I have. And, you know, I'm honored to be able to tell my dad's story. I'm sad I have to do it, but I think of how many other stories there are out there in our country that don't get told.
Indeed. Indeed. Erin, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Please go and tell this story to more people. I hope you get to tell some teabaggers, because they need to understand the reality of that for which they pray. So good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. From Montana, that is Erin of Montana, with a cautionary tale for all of us, and especially those who want more. That's what the teabaggers are. They're the more suffering people. And I just can't understand being that. I can't understand in the least. I'm told that my next guest is ready. That would be Elizabeth Widra? Widra. Should have trusted my first impulse. Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's a pleasure. I have to tell you something. They didn't give me a bio for you.
Oh, no.
So my sincere apologies if we just take this from the very ground up and talk about
Sure. What
brings you to Radio Row today.
Exactly.
And the nature of your advocacy.
Okay.
So let's start from there.
Okay, great. My name is Elizabeth Widra. I'm the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which is a think tank, law firm, and action center devoted to fulfilling the progressive promise of our Constitution's text and history.
Yay!
Exactly.
So you're the person I can talk to about the necessary and proper
clause
and the Commerce Clause and the general welfare
exactly.
clause.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, so I did. Wait for this conversation all day long.
Excellent. I love people who want to talk about the Constitution.
Well, I do, because it is a living document, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, I'm sure it's carved in stone somewhere, just like the Ten Commandments, but it has a reality for the 21st century.
Absolutely. You think what the only concern I have with the living document thing is that it makes it seem like there's something that we can't find in the Constitution, that we have to change it. But the brilliance of our Constitution is that it uses words like equality that has expansive meaning. And fortunately, over the 220 years that we've had the Constitution, we the people have amended it to make it more equal,
yes.
to include more people within our democratic society.
Well, we're talking about a document that was drafted at a time when equality was deemed to mean equality for white landed property owners, leaving out, you know, a significant portion of the population generally, because there were more persons of color in the South than there were white folks, and leaving out women altogether. So we have to have that more expansive definition if we're going to consider ourselves 21st century people, don't we?
Right. And fortunately, the text of the Constitution allows for that expansive notion. And so that's what I love about it. And that's why it's a progressive document. In terms of the Affordable Care Act cases, it's a perfect example. You know, when the founders wrote the Constitution and thought about interstate commerce, they, you know, of course they didn't think that, you know, in 2012 we'd have the healthcare industry comprised 20% of our nation's economy.
Right.
But it does. And when you look at the Constitution, what the folks who wrote it intended was to create a central government with the power to create national solutions to national problems.
And they had just been through, they had dealt with the Articles of Confederation. They knew what happened when the federal government was unable to referee squabbles between incredibly contentious individual states. So the Commerce Clause comes in as a direct response to that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Articles of Confederation were such a failure that George Washington once lamented that they nearly cost Americans victory in the Revolutionary War. And so they learned a lesson from that. They learned that we needed a sufficiently energetic federal government, and the Articles of Confederation did not have an interstate commerce clause.
No.
They made sure to put one in our enduring Constitution. And, you know, it's funny because the Tea Party talks on and on about the Constitution, but the version that they're talking about really has more in common with the Articles of Confederation.
Well, and I think that's what they ultimately want. You know, I'm a big fan of The Onion. And sometimes they get a little bit too close to reality. They had an article a year or so ago, and the title of it was Man is Passionate Defender of Constitution That Exists Only in His Head.
I remember that.
And I mean, I printed it out, and it's there for easy reference, because that's what I think of when I see the Tea Party out here talking about stuff. I had a woman who claimed to be a physician today telling me that the Affordable Care Act would prevent doctors from being able to prescribe mammograms, and just because she wanted to be non-sexist, and PSA tests for men. I've read the law. I've read it when it was a bill. I've read it now.
Yeah.
It's a law. It's not in there. But they're willing to make things up as they go along.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk for a minute, if you please, about the general welfare clause.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Scalia has made it clear that he thinks that general welfare, as referred to in the preamble, has no... It's meaningless, that the whole preamble is just meaningless. But that's not the only place that phrase exists, is it? There is greater reference to it within the body of the document, the ability of the Congress to make sure that the country functions in a non-dysfunctional manner. And I guess that sounds a little goofy, but it's there, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and relevant to the case the Affordable Care Act case and the arguments this morning and yesterday, which I was in the courtroom for.
So you did hear them?
Yeah. You know, the Congress has the power to tax and spend, quote, for the general welfare. And the Obama administration is arguing that the minimum coverage provision and the shared responsibility payment, if you don't have that minimum level of insurance, is a tax for the general welfare. You know, there are certainly other provisions of the Constitution, like the Commerce Clause and the Necessary
Right.
and Proper Clause, that also support it. But, you know, and the other thing that I think is really interesting that, you know, these Tea Party historians certainly wouldn't tell you is that when the drafters of the Constitution were considering what powers to give to the federal government, they passed a resolution in the Constitutional Convention that would give the federal government, that they said, okay, when we're sitting down to write this, our guiding principle is going to be Resolution 6, which they passed. And it said that the federal government would have the power to act when the states were unable to act, when the states were acting in a way contrary to the interests of the union, and when it just was better for there to be a federal solution, a national solution, than individual state action. So this idea of the federal government being empowered to act in the best interest of the country as a whole was the motivating principle behind the enumerated powers in the Constitution.
Well, what then is the nexus with the Tea Party argument about, because they seem to have this standard response when you bring any of this up, and they start howling, Tenth Amendment. If the government is empowered to act, is empowered to act when the states either refuse to or act discordantly with national interest, what does that do to the Tenth Amendment and the reservation of rights?
Yeah, so you know the Tenth Amendment doesn't sort of negate the rest of the Constitution, which gives very strong powers to the federal government. So if you look at Article 1, Section 8, which gives power to Congress, including the power to regulate interstate commerce and tax and spend for the general welfare, those powers are granted to Congress. And what the Tea Partiers are trying to say when they invoke the Tenth Amendment is that they don't want Congress to exercise its constitutionally granted powers. But that's not how things work. The Tenth Amendment essentially just says, you know, Congress has to point to a power in the Constitution that it's using, as opposed to the states, which sort of have a, you know, more general power.
Mm.
But, you know, when Congress points to a particular power, the Commerce Clause power, for example, that power is limited only by the other provisions of the Constitution. So, you know, for example, in the healthcare law, if I wanted to pass a regulation that said, you know, you can engage in an unreasonable search and seizure of healthcare companies' records as part of the regulation, that wouldn't be okay because it would violate the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Sure.
But there's no right in the Constitution to freeload off one's neighbors if you choose to be self-insured and pass, you know, billions of dollars in uncompensated care costs onto the
people
rest
who are
of,
being responsible.
Exactly, who are being responsible, playing by the rules, buying insurance. And end up paying, you know, the average family pays about $1,000 more every year in their premiums because of the uninsured.
Well, I'm a student of history, Elizabeth, and one of the things that drives me crazy out of all this, and frankly frightens me, is that so many of these arguments, and in fact, some of the stuff that led this litigation to the Supreme Court today, has been sort of bathed or swaddled in a within the confines of nullificationism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the sort of thing that led us to that little dust-up in 1860 that there are so many monuments to around this town.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the states have a unilateral right to declare which federal laws they will and will not obey. I don't know if you saw it since you were there to witness the arguments, but outside there were some people with their Gadsden flag,
mm-hmm,
and a sign that said, "We will not comply."
Mm-hmm.
This is frightening for our country. Is it disturbing to you?
It is. You know, and I think the one thing that makes me feel better about it is that I represent state legislators from across the country and who are supporting the health care law, and there are other states and state leaders who have said that they do not agree with the, quote, states' rights position of the challenger states and of those folks who are standing outside with their flags. And, in fact, they're saying, don't tread on me to the challenging states, saying you don't represent what I think is the proper role between the states and the federal government. But I think it is concerning that there are people who clearly and vigorously believe that the states can not comply with validly enacted federal law. That is, our Constitution does not allow it. We fought a bloody civil war to bring that point home.
And the problem with the issue is that it didn't just crop up in 1859. This is something that has plagued our country for a big chunk of the 19th century, because it began with the tariff troubles with South
mm-hmm.
Carolina and the Jackson presidency, and he said he would go to South Carolina and hang the first person he saw, and he would continue hanging them until it, and that made South Carolina calm down for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and then of course you get to 1860 and everything falls apart. What do you expect as someone who watches this process, who deals with state legislatures, what do you expect their next step to be if the Affordable Care Act is found to be constitutional? In fact, is there going to be some great wave of civil disobedience that we're going to witness?
Well, you know, I hope what they do is what the founders thought they would do, which is to use the power of the ballot box. And, you know, I think that the Affordable Care Act is a great step in the right direction from a policy matter. But you know what? If you don't like it, don't try and make your arguments in the court. Don't try and seek a political do-over of what you couldn't accomplish in the legislature in the courts. That's not what the courts are there for, and that's not what this case is really about. This case is about the Constitution. And if the court finds it constitutional, and if you still think the law is a bad law and you don't want to have access to affordable, quality health care, then vote accordingly. But that's, you know, there's no need to engage in civil disobedience.
But these are the self-same people who have not been slowed down since 1973 in Roe versus Wade. That's, you know, it's settled law and has been settled law for almost 40 years now. And they're not letting up. I grow, even though it provides me great fodder on a nightly basis for the show, I grow weary of it. And for, you know, for the sake of my son, whom you saw a moment ago, and mm-hmm. my daughters at home, my grandchildren, I grow fearful of it for them. And I wonder if the country can stand another 50 years of this kind of divisiveness. It's frightening. The Constitution is a profoundly flexible the brilliant document, literally drafted by, no kidding, probably the greatest ingathering of geniuses that this nation may have ever known and may ever know. And I think people like Madison and the other framers, they anticipated a lot of things. They anticipated people of ill will. It's clear from mm-hmm. reading the Federalist Papers. You know, Federalist 10, when Madison
right.
talks about the poison of faction,
mm-hmm.
It's obvious there that he is literally thinking in the future, and
right.
he had the mind to do it. But I don't know if they anticipated people being so ill-informed, because that's the one break they cut the American people. They thought that they were going to really participate and care about their country.
Well, you know, it may be apocryphal, I don't know, but there's the story that when Benjamin Franklin was coming out on the streets while the Constitution was being drafted, a woman asked him, you know, what kind of government are you creating? And he said, a republic, madam, if you can keep it.
If you can keep it. We will end on that, Elizabeth Wydra. It is a pleasure talking to you. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
It's my pleasure.
I wish you all the best. I'd love to talk more about what you actually heard in there today. But,
this is much more interesting.
Well, thank you very kindly.
Thank
and have
you,
a wonderful
Bob.
Afternoon. Bye now. Elizabeth Wydra, and coming up, and I've been waiting to have that constitutional discussion for 2 days now, and it was wonderful. Joining us now, a man who I have no problem saying has assumed the mantle of a hero to me for what he has been willing to do over the past several years. Wendell Potter is with us now. Whistleblower, a man among men. Got some headphones here for you if they would help you any.
Very
at all.
Good. Thanks, Bob.
It was Wendell Potter who first made it abundantly apparent the manipulation, the outright evil that the insurance industry was engaging in where health care was concerned. And he joins us now. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
We're seeing this. I'm sure you saw the protest as you came in. There's a lot of people. I'm pleased to say there's a lot of people out there supporting the Affordable Care Act, but there are a great number of people as well who are demanding the right for people to get sick and die without health care coverage, which I frankly can't wrap my mind around. You have seen the inside of the workings of the insurance industry. How much manipulation of the process, of the discussion of the Affordable Care Act has been driven from inside the PR operations of the healthcare industry?
Oh, it's been enormous. In fact, I would say that probably most of the manipulation can be traced back to the insurance industry. Keep in mind, there is a conventional wisdom that the insurance industry would like to see this law declared unconstitutional. It's not true. And so a lot of these folks who are out there protesting don't realize that those that they are presumably representing, or they're not representing their own best interest, that what the insurance industry would love to have more than anything else is that the Affordable Care Act go forward, but that these people who are out there marching will elect people who are more friendly to the insurance industry, that they'll control Congress next year and they'll control the White House next year, so that they'll be more inclined to strip out the consumer protections in the Affordable Care Act. It's a very it's a very sinister approach to government.
Cynical into the bargain, too.
It is, exactly. And they're very able, they're adept at manipulating public opinion. That's what I was part of for many years.
It would be wonderful to, for instance, have a mandate for a person to have to carry health care and yet at the same time not have any requirements to provide anything going in the other direction. That's basically what we're talking about, isn't it?
It's what we're talking about. The insurance industry would love to be able to require us all to buy their products, but they don't want to live by the new regulations that are in the Act, the things that protect them from their worst practices that have led to 50 million of us not having insurance, and to enable them to refuse to sell us coverage when we get sick or after we've been sick, that enables them to cancel someone's coverage just because they want to.
Are you prepared to say, and now this is not confrontational, but are you prepared to say that we are reaching a time in America when the ability of people's illness, agony, suffering, death should not be a function of the profit motive? I mean, are we there yet?
We're not there yet because most people don't realize what the consequences have been since we allowed Wall Street to take over our healthcare system. But it'll become increasingly evident of what that really is. More and more of us are finding out that that the for-profit companies are more interested in meeting the bottom line expectations, meeting Wall Street's expectations, and what the consequences of that soul-minded focus is on the rest of us, which is contributing to people not getting the care they need. There really are death panels. Some of these people who are marching out here are saying and believing that the Affordable Care Act would set up death panels. It does
right.
not. But they do exist, and they exist today inside these big for-profit health insurance companies, any health insurance company that operates today, and they're just not recognizing it.
Well, I just spoke to a young woman just a few minutes ago whose father was put through the living hell of trying to get a bone marrow transplant.
Hmm.
And he was, of course, denied. And then eventually they gave in after the cancer had come back and after he became basically... The insurance companies... delay tactics were, in essence, a death sentence.
And they often are.
And that's the function of a real death panel, isn't it?
It really is. I tell the story of a young 17-year-old girl who was scheduled to have a liver transplant.
I know this story.
And
Cigna?
Cigna was her family's health insurer. She was scheduled to have a liver transplant that her doctors felt would save her life, that she would live at least 5 years. She had leukemia, and the family's doctors, or the girl's doctors, had a liver waiting to transplant into her. When the insurance company said, sorry, we're not going to cover this because we don't think it's medically appropriate for Nadalene Sarkeesian, that was the girl's name.
Yes.
So you see, what we have in this country, we have people who work for big insurance companies making these kinds of decisions. The person who made that decision had not seen Nadalene, had not examined her, had just made an opinion based on some paperwork that he didn't want to pay for her liver transplant.
And let's be clear, there are a lot of these stories, and this is a function. There are structures within health insurance companies in which people are paid year-end bonuses based on the coverage they have denied. I mean, that's the truth, isn't it?
It is true. In fact, one company in California had to pay a considerable fine when it was disclosed that the company actually had paid employees' bonuses to find reasons to cancel people's coverage. This is how, you know, there are many ways that these companies avoid paying for our care when we think that they're obligated to do so.
Well, let me ask you this then, and I think this is, if there is a troubling aspect to the Affordable Care Act, this is it or part of it. Given the way that we have seen health insurance companies behave, can they be trusted with any portion the ACA as it is presently constituted? Even if there are mandatory obligations put upon them, for instance, you know, no rejections for pre-existing conditions, that sort of thing. Isn't their natural inclination, Mr. Potter, going to be to constantly look for loopholes, to find ways to short-circuit people's coverage?
Yes, that is true. But my hope is, and my belief is, that the Affordable Care Act will make health insurance coverage less profitable for them than it has been in the past. They will not be able to do some of the things that we've talked about that have enabled them to make such big profits. And these companies are already diversifying. They're getting into other businesses that they think can provide a bigger profit margin. So my belief is that ultimately these companies that are for-profit will get out of the business of providing basic coverage, and that we'll go back to having nonprofit companies do that, at least as an interim step before we get to a more equitable solution for our health, to bring more people into universal
moving
coverage.
Moving toward a universal health care sort of model.
Right.
How much within the for-profit healthcare industry, how much actually goes to healthcare provision as opposed to advertising and, you know, imprinted golf balls for physicians and all the little gym cracks and things, and then ultimately bonuses and massive salaries? In other words, if they were running on a leaner, more Medicare resemblant model, what would happen inside an insurance? Would they just walk away from the business?
Yeah, they would. It would change so radically that they'd walk away from it. We spend in this country about over $2 trillion a year on health care in one way or another, and it's estimated that about 30% of that is spent on various what they call administrative functions, and that includes the golf balls, the imprinted golf balls.
I'm sorry, that's just my...
Yeah, but it's true. It's true. And the ability of CEOs to travel on private jets and to be paid enormous salaries. The guy who last year was at the very top of Forbes' most highly compensated CEO list was the president of one of these big for-profit companies. They pay their executives enormous amounts of money. But the other thing is that the way that we have our insurance system in this country, it means that the healthcare providers also have to spend enormous amounts of money on administration that they otherwise wouldn't have to spend. Doctors' offices and hospitals have to have armies of staff people who do nothing more than just deal day in and day out with insurance companies and trying to make sure that they get paid, and the insurance company
coders and
right, and the insurance company people want to try to do all they can to make sure they don't pay them what they should be paying them.
It strikes me that one understands that in a legal situation, that our system is predicated on an adversarial system.
It is.
And you know, you can understand that there's one side, there's two sides to every fight, and sometimes ten. But in the process of trying to get someone cured of cancer, or trying to get a heart transplant in light of recent news, that shouldn't be adversarial, should it? The adversarial nature of the relationship is created by the profit motive, isn't it?
It is. And in this country, probably more than any other country, we have this notion that everything is better if it's done in a competitive way. But that does set up these adversarial relationships that you're speaking of. What we really need more of is collaboration, in which the various entities work more collaboratively to ensure that a patient has...
Where everybody's going in the same direction.
That's exactly right. And when you do that, you can begin to take the cost out of the system and make sure that people have the outcomes for people are where they should be.
Well, I can only hope that we get toward a universal system sooner rather than later. Do you have any sense... going back up, you said it's not necessarily that the insurance companies want to see the Affordable Care Act overturned. They just want to, because they've got to like the idea of having mandatory customers.
They do. They like that, and the
less they can do for them, the better.
That's exactly right.
Then, do you have any idea which way? If they're not driving this opposition to the Affordable Care Act, it can't all be the Tea Party. Where's the real force behind this opposition?
Well, keep in mind that much of this is a smokescreen for what the insurance industry really wants. I mean, this is the impression that the industry and a lot of its allies really want this overturned. It's not true. It's a smokescreen for what they really want to do, which is to keep the individual mandate intact. And keep in mind that the individual mandate was an idea that originated in a conservative think tank here in Washington.
The Heritage Foundation,
the Heritage,
right?
Foundation. So it is a conservative idea that was sold to the president and Democratic leaders as maybe a way to get bipartisan support.
Well, this is the Dole plan from 1992, isn't it?
Absolutely is. Absolutely is. So it is a plan that has been embraced by conservative politicians and even by Republican candidates for president right now.
Well, then to a certain extent, are we bearing witness to some sort of great kabuki play?
Absolutely. It's enormous deception. It's very, very devious what's going on. That's why I wrote the book called Deadly Spin, to try to pull the curtains back on how this is done and why it's done. It's all very devious. It's all done very much behind the scenes. A lot of our premium dollars our money is funneled into campaigns to make us second guess the reasons for having health care reform, not to overturn it, not to get it repealed, but to elect people who are friends of the insurance industry so that when they're in office, they will strip out the consumer protections and leave what the insurance industry wants, which
likes.
Is yeah, exactly.
So they're going in essence, they're hoping that the Supreme Court will take a scalpel to the statute and not a butcher knife.
That's right. And they are so successful in manipulating public opinion that you've got people here in town who are outside marching and calling for the law to be declared unconstitutional.
Cannon fodder in the culture wars?
Absolutely what it is.
Wendell Potter, I've hoped to have a conversation with you for a very long time. I'm glad it finally came true today.
Me too.
Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
we are back. I am joined now. It's about 7 minutes past the hour. I'm joined by Celinda Lake. She is president of Lake Research Partners. She's a political strategist with the Democratic Party. And she does tactical work and advisory work to the National Party committees. And so I would suggest that it is probably a good bet that Ms. Lake, you can probably speak to questions of what if on either end of the decisional spectrum with regard to the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
What happens to the Democratic Party? You know, I would prefer that this be a discussion, I don't mean yours and mine,
mm-hmm.
but the larger national discussion, I would prefer that it be a discussion about whether people can go to the doctor when they're sick.
Amen.
Unfortunately, we have a political chattering class that would prefer to make it about a horse race or some sort of meaningless statistical squabble. But with that in mind,
are totally fictitious things like death panels, which don't exist.
Well, I got up this morning, and all of the morning news programs are completely worthless to me.
Wow.
So I defaulted over to Morning Joe simply for the circus-like entertainment quality. I heard exactly what you're discussing or what you're describing. There sat Joe Scarborough describing things about the Affordable Care Act that completely did not exist.
It's amazing. I mean, fiction as fact is just unbelievable. But I think the most important thing, and you raise it, is to have a conversation about what are the real components. You know what's ironic? Even though the voters today, first of all, most voters say they're not paying attention. Most voters say they don't know what's in the bill. They're remarkably honest here. But the people that have an opinion tend to lean against the bill, and it tends to be very much on partisan lines. When we have a conversation, though, about what's in the bill, every single provision of this act, except for the mandate, is popular between 65 and 85% of the voters like it. That's more popular than every single politician who will oppose this bill. So our job is to make this about the conversation about health care and our goals in health care reform, not about politics.
I will go so far as to say that from the view from where I sit has been one for a number of years where it has felt like our side has been in a constant mode of playing catch up,
mm-hmm.
and planned reacting and being
That's
reactive
right.
instead of proactive in our messaging. Why is that, and how do we change it?
Boy, the why is a long question. And
is that the six-hour radio
That's
show
a
question?
Six-hour radio show, but I'd love to be a panelist on it. And it is frustrating. I think part of it is that we tend to think the facts matter more than they do. And as you can see on Morning Joe, that the fiction is far more powerful than the facts. I think that we don't seize control of it early enough and define what the legislation is really about. I think we're not as powerful on message. We don't tend to think about what our message is, and then we shy away from talking about it. We should have leaned into health care reform. We should have been defining it from the get-go, and actually I'm really glad that the president at least has signaled that for better or for worse, he's going to talk about it. Because either you talk about it now and define it, or that's all we talk about in September and October, and we're on the defense again.
Is that one of the beauties of at least having this thing decided in June?
It's a beauty of having it decided in June, and I think it's also a beauty of having the presidency, because we have the bully pulpit to define what this thing is all about. And we have the ability to say to people, what do you want to do? Do you want to take away free prevention visit for grandma? Do you want to do away with insurance companies covering birth control, which is expensive for a lot of families in these tough economic times? Do you want to allow an insurance company to deny a child coverage because they have a so-called pre-existing condition? Do you want to take your 25-year-old kid who doesn't have a job and is back on your couch off of health insurance? I mean, which one of these things do you want to do?
And see, that's exactly how this discussion needs to have gone forward, and it seems like it's exactly how it hasn't.
I agree with you. It's very frustrating.
These out of an abundance of trying to be decent, I'll call them Tea Party people. That's not the phrase I usually use. When I hear them say, "Oh, it's about my liberty," it's about my freedom. Well, how free are you if you're free to die uninsured from something that is utterly preventable?
Right.
If you've got coverage, because that's a reality. We have American citizens who die every year to the tune of 45 to 48,000 people. They don't die because they got some disease that can't be treated. They died because they got something and couldn't be treated because they didn't have insurance. I mean, we need the AMA to define a new disease.
Right.
Called,
death by lack of insurance.
Yeah, an insurance-itis or whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
Something Greek, the absence of insurance.
That's right.
And whether it's freedom or liberty or, this latest thing where suddenly the right wing are the only people on the planet who have consciences, I mean, it makes me nuts. And
also, think about the number of families that went bankrupt because of health care. Freedom to lose your house, freedom to lose everything you saved for, when you paid for your insurance. Also, if you have secret ceilings in your policies because you're a cancer survivor, if you have a pre-existing condition, this doesn't even mean when you don't have insurance. This means freedom to go bankrupt when you have insurance.
Yes.
And you've been paying your premiums your entire life.
We're not talking about the boys under the bridge drinking the screw top wine. No, I had Spike Ward on earlier.
Yeah.
She was talking about, that L.A. Times op-ed that she wrote where she said, we're good people. We have a house. We've been responsible.
Worked all their lives. Paid their insurance premiums their whole lives.
And still get hung out to dry.
That's exactly right.
And, I don't know how many these Tea Party people are that way. One disaster away from everything falling apart, but I suspect it's probably a much larger number than they suspect.
Right, that's right.
And yet, right now, down there at the South Park of the Senate,
right,
they're losing their, they're having their little, snake handling thing, whatever it is they do. And I wonder, from your standpoint of your expertise in dealing with women's political issues, getting women candidates elected within a progressive framework. Can we turn this to our advantage in November? And I speak specifically toward, I'm not that worried about President Obama.
Right.
I know it's a fight. I know it
right.
is.
That's
a lot,
right.
There's a lot of ugly Citizens United money out there. I get that. But is there even some remote chance of retaking the House? Can we save the Senate?
Yeah.
A second Obama term in which he spends 4 years just
right
beating back the reactionary impulses of a Republican House and Senate, I mean, that's too much. That's almost as bad as the alternative.
That's exactly right. I would say this. I am a huge believer in our ability to take back the House. And I also think that for the first time we have the ability to take back the House with progressives, not with these blue dogs who vote like Republicans. This is amazing. And yet we can't get anybody focused on it. We only need 25 seats. There are 14 seats that Kerry and Obama won. There are another 5 seats that look good for us because of Obama and because of reapportionment. That takes us to 19 seats. All we have to do is get 6 more seats, and we have control of the House. We can do this.
Does the DCCC understand that?
No, they really understand it, and they're working hard on it. But all of our funders on our side don't tend to believe in it, don't tend to understand it. And that's what we need.
I'm guilty because I've preached that it's a foregone conclusion, that it's not going to happen.
Ah.
So, no, I'm happy to be corrected. Because,
You're breaking my heart here.
No, I'm sorry, because what I saw was, in 2010, we saw those blue dog imitation Republican light members of Congress get bounced in favor
right.
of having the real brand.
Right.
In light of the fact that those people were in places like Tennessee and Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi and Oklahoma, whatever, to the extent that they were there, I just didn't see their constituents saying, no, we're suddenly feeling very progressive. and undoing that. But you're telling me that there are opportunities outside those places.
That's right. There are opportunities outside those places. And also in a presidential year, some of those places don't look the same. I mean, here are two things. We saw the participation of people of color, of young people, and of unmarried women absolutely collapse in 2010.
Yes.
And we also saw women vote Republican for the first time in 37 years. If we get independent women back, and if we get people of color, younger people, and unmarried women turn out up, we can win. And the presidency helps a lot with that. And frankly, the healthcare issue helps a lot with that. Healthcare is a women's issue. And talking to independent women about, you know what, we're going to make sure that the insurance company covers your birth control. We're not going to let being a woman be a pre-existing condition. And while it's mildly annoying that you get charged more for your dry cleaning, it's really enraging that you get charged more for your healthcare. And we're going to make that illegal, too.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful messaging. It really is. I've seen all this war on women stuff, and it's mm-hmm. it's revolting to me as a guy. I'm
right,
you know?
Exactly.
Because sooner or later, if they're going after birth control pills, I've tried to tell guys, you know, I'm gonna quit with it. They're gonna go after the condoms too. It's not like you're gonna get a pass.
Right. That's exactly right.
No, birth control is birth control.
That's right, and it's a family decision.
Theocracy.
Right. Once politicians start choosing what's in your insurance plan, then where do they go? Do they go to HIV medication? Do they say heart medication?
Sure.
What other judgment do they make?
What I guess I'm asking, though, is that from the standpoint of the Republican war on women, is it, because I saw one, I forget whose poll it was, CBS maybe, mm-hmm. that said women really didn't care about the war on women. Do you have data to the contrary?
Yeah, we do. And first of all, the war on women honestly isn't the best term. It's kind of a political term. It's kind of an aggressive term. But women care a lot about being in touch with their lives. Women care a lot about whether politicians are making decisions that should be personal decisions. And interestingly, when you get to the specifics and you talk about 65% of women and 60% of men, to your point, disagree that employers should be able to deny coverage for birth control because they don't believe in it, because it's not their religion. Fine, that's your religion. That's not my religion. You shouldn't have a say over what is in my...
Yeah, who
my...
said you're the only one in this country with a conscience?
Right.
I was out protesting the Iraq war. What, that didn't
right.
matter?
Right.
I didn't get to withhold my taxes.
Right, exactly right. So I think that these are very powerful issues. They're powerful with men and women. And the nice thing about the Tea Party is, and here's another piece of evidence about why we can take back the House. Usually by now, people who had taken such wildly unpopular positions would be saying, oh, I was misunderstood. I really meant
this. You took me out of context.
Right, you took me out of context. Now they're saying, oh, no, I believe in doing away with Medicare. Here's my second attempt to do it. These people are unrepentant. Voters voted for change. They did not vote for this kind of change, and they'll reject this kind of change.
Ms. Lake, I certainly hope that you are correct. And
thanks to your help for making it happen.
I don't know how much I'm helping, but it's been a joy meeting you. And
nice to be on your show. Thank you.
I hope that down the road we get to have a little bit more in the way of conversation, because we need smart messaging out there. And you know, I want a president who's going. I know a lot of people have gotten real cranky, but I really do. I want to see the bully pulpit stuff in the next
six months. Absolutely. You and me both.
I'm not demanding that he take his shoe off and pound on the podium like Khrushchev or anything, but it would be nice to see some out front advocacy.
That's right. And he's doing it more and more, and it's making a big difference.
Thank you
so much.
Have a great day.
Bye now.
Celinda Lake, delightful conversation. It was indeed. With her talking messaging like that, I hope that the Democratic Party is listening.
Oh, thanks. She's really nice.
Throw rocks if you have to.
I will.
All right. Take care. Hi. Just 1 second. You weren't on my schedule, but you are now.
I've got one piece of paper.
then your piece of paper wins.
Let's see. Are you Bob Kincaid?
I am.
Here you go.
Don't worry, it happens all the time.
Okay. Well, you know, it's cool. The only downside to this is I don't have a bio. So we will start from the very ground. You are Cincy Hernandez Cancio, and you are the director of health equity, and you're with Families USA, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful. Let's start then very plainly. What is the nature of your advocacy?
So I work in Families USA focused on making sure that people of color both understand the importance of healthcare reform and also working on issues of making sure that the implementation of healthcare reform is done in a way that maximizes health equity. In other words, that minimizes healthcare disparities in this country.
Okay. Within that description, then, I guess maybe I'm engaging in wishful thinking, but has convincing the community of color that the Affordable Care Act is good for them, has that been an uphill struggle or is it challenging?
Well, the challenge has not been so much changing people's minds. The challenge is that there's just not a lot of information out there in ways that people can digest. And we've seen this across the board, not just with communities of color, that, for example, you look at polling and you ask people what do they think of Obamacare and they don't like it so much, but when you start telling them exactly what's in it, they love it. So that's
right. What do you think of Obamacare? Hate it.
Yeah.
What do you think of telling insurance companies that they can't just throw you off your coverage willy-nilly? Well, that's the way it ought to be.
Right, exactly. Right. You know, what do you think about the fact that your kid, when he graduates from college, can still stay on your plan until he's 26? Yay, we love that. You know, what do you think of preventive care without copays? Fantastic. So the challenge is more making sure that people, regular people, that we talk to people. Here in Washington, it's very hard for us to remember to talk to people like just normal people talk, because we don't talk like normal people here,
yeah,
right?
This is a different place.
So it's a challenge across the board, but then it becomes even more challenging. You have to make sure that you're dealing with the right, you know, representatives, you know, the trusted sources of information, that you are, you know, saying things in a culturally that really relates to the real reality of the people you're talking to. And then with Latinos and some other groups and Asian American groups, then you have other issues of language as well. You want to make sure that the message is coming out in ways people understand.
Is it?
There are a lot of us that have been working on this. Actually, even HHS has been working even more on trying to get this information out. You know, for example, their healthcare.gov site is actually Cuidado de Salud, you know, in Spanish. So they're working on it. I think all of us understand that we have to do a lot better. And we are trying our best to coordinate and collaborate to do a better job on this.
Well, one of the things that, and we were having this discussion a little bit earlier today, for instance, on January 1st, 2014, when what I think is one of the most exciting parts of the Affordable Care Act comes into play, the Medicaid expansion. I don't think of necessarily demographics as much as I think of fungigraphics, namely poor folks.
Mm-hmm.
How, whether it's DHHS or NGOs or whatever, how do you, on January 1st, 2014, how do you let people know, you know, hooray, good for you, this is a great day for America, this is a great day for you, you are no longer uninsured?
Well, I'm so glad you've asked that question, because it's hugely important. I mean, as you know, Latinos, for example, have the group with the highest rates of uninsurance. 1 in 3 Latinos don't have insurance. 1 in 4 black people don't have insurance. And then if you add in, layer over that, the income levels, we know for sure that the groups that are most likely to benefit and benefit the greatest from some the coverage expansions, not only Medicaid, but also the exchange subsidies,
right,
for working class people. And we can't wait till, as you said, January 1st, 2014 to do that. There are groups, and we've been working with a variety of groups, including a group called Enroll America, that's laser focused on making sure that we have the public education campaigns starting next year, not 2014, but starting next year, so that the word is out and people know that they have options. Because right now people are really struggling. People don't know what to do, and they don't know that there's options out there for them. So it's very important that we, and they're used to that. They're used to going without. So we need to change that dynamic so that people say, you know, guess what? You don't have to go without, and there are options for your family. You can take care of yourself and your family members, and you don't have to suffer the way you've been suffering for so long anymore.
And I have to think that will be a huge moment for people to just breathe a tremendous sigh of relief, whether it be pre-existing conditions or as you described, the exchanges themselves, all of those mechanisms that are in there, it's going to be a tremendous relief for people. And I think it's incredibly important that we be, as I was talking with Ms. Lake, that we be messaging on this right now.
And actually, people are breathing huge sighs of relief right now. You know, the mom who doesn't have to worry about their young adult who just graduated having health care, there are 2.5 million parents out there right now breathing enormous sighs of relief about that. There are many seniors, millions of seniors right now who are breathing huge sighs of relief over the fact that they don't have to pay so much in the donut hole. They can get their medications covered. All of the parents of children with some serious, you know, children that are born with birth defects or children with, like, serious asthma, mm-hmm. who don't have to worry about their insurance companies denying them for pre-existing conditions. That's all in play already. And then there's all, for those of us who already have insurance, all those protections. You know, knowing that for every $5 you spend on a premium, a company can't pay, use more than one for profits and overhead, that's like a relief to me that who keeps paying, you
and
know,
it,
paying
and,
out
and
paying out for premiums.
It stuns me to this day that's in the legislation. You know, that kind of what are we going to call that? An extravagance cap?
Yeah. The greed cap?
Yeah. It amazes me that it's in there. And again, it's something that I never would have known about had I not been coming to these events.
Yeah.
And if I'm plugged into this stuff and I don't know, I gotta wonder the degree to which.
That is the challenge.
A lot of people don't.
And that's a challenge. And how about the fact that, you know, an insurance company can't raise your premium more than 10% without permission? Did you know about that?
Yeah. Permission
from the state.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a review. You know, they have to justify the fact that they really are increasing their costs, not their overhead, not their, you know, not their...
Not
the profits that they're going to pay out, you know, the dividends they're paying out for
the
their investors. Yeah, exactly.
CEO's Ferrari,
but that they actually really did have to increase their premiums that much. You know, there's some people who are going to be getting checks in the mail about that. But, again, a lot for us to educate.
Well, Cincy Hernandez-Concio, and I've got the name right.
You did very well.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you coming by, and I thank you for the information. And I
thank you so much.
Thank you most of all for the dedication of your work.
Thank you. I really appreciate
you're
that.
You're working on the side of the angels.
I hope so.
I know so. Take care. From Families USA, Director of Health Equity, Cincy Hernandez-Concio. And we will move on to Bob Wiener, my old buddy. I was wondering if we were going to get to talk.
Well, we make a point of it with you.
And you're my last guest of the day, so.
Well, I'm honored. Are we live?
Yeah, we absolutely
okay.
are. Well, I'm about half. I've been up since about 5.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a headset there for you.
If you're live, you're more than our case in the court right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you haven't heard?
No.
Robert said, if we do the mandate, it takes us to broccoli and gyms. I mean, it's just what was
that?
Predicted.
Okay, no, stop.
What we predicted in our op-ed.
What's the broccoli business? I
force you to eat broccoli if they force you to have health care. It's such a bullshit argument. Anyway, we can do that.
That's okay. And by the way, we can say that on the Internet, that word.
You can?
Yeah. Yeah. I like broccoli.
Well, you have the right to like it or not like it. I respected George Bush's not liking it.
So you're obviously tuned in. You're the first.
I made a point of it. You know, you do homework before you walk over. You know. So.
Yeah. But no. But
so I listened to Tubin, who said that the case is going down. That's what Jeff Tubin's assessment was on CNN.
Well, I just had an email from my head writer, who said in an email titled "Well, damn it."
But it was predictable. Who thought? Did anybody think the Bush v. Gore and the Citizens United case court would do anything different but go 5-4 on this?
I had Rick Unger sitting right where you're sitting yesterday say it was going to be 7-2, 8-1 in favor.
What Tubin said was the only thing you can say about the four liberal justices is that there's four of them.
Jesus. Now, David just wrote to me a little bit ago and says the tenor of the NPR coverage is that the SCOTUS will rule against the ACA. These are the same sort of justice types that thought slavery was ordained by God in 1830.
Well, I don't go there. But, I mean, I go to Bush v. Gore and Citizens United and predictable on the basis of who appointed them. You know, I'm a practical progressive, not a fringy one. So.
Well, but I'm a mean one. And
yeah,
I know.
Right.
And I'm, And I know what the Tawney Court was.
Right, yeah.
It was not all Dred Scott, but they gave us Dred Scott.
Yeah. But I do want to use the line of the Republicans claim they want liberty, but they want to have liberty and death, because death is what you get without health insurance, 20,000 people.
Well, and see, that's the thing, Bob. It's
give me liberty and give me death.
No, their version of liberty is out of a song, okay? This is me and Bobby McGee, okay? This is freedom's nothing more than nothing left to lose. And that's what they mean when they talk about freedom.
The press release that I want to work from. No, I need mine. Yeah, the one that's marked up somewhere.
Okay.
It was right here.
We were talking about a piece. Is this Bad Signs from the Supreme Court?
You got that one. That's good. That's my release that I work from. And here it is. Okay. The one where I've circled stuff.
Okay, so we are talking about the same thing.
That's yours.
But you're free to use it.
No, but it means I left one.
Then that may be yours, because it's mine.
I had a... Where's my blue pen? The gold last interview I had. And then I've got another one. But okay. All right. Anytime you're ready, I'm ready.
I'm born ready.
Okay.
So... this is titled Bad Signs from the Supreme Court for Health Law.
Oh, have we been on all this time?
Yeah, we're on. Yeah, we're.
We've been on all this time. I thought we were.
This is live radio, baby. This is the crash of the Hindenburg. I mean, yeah, no, we're doing great, man. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. But no, you've written Bad Signs from the Supreme Court for Health Law. And you think it was just terrible in there today, right?
Well, you had the Chief Justice saying that if we can do this, there's no limits. And exactly what we were afraid of, and what I put in my October Palm Beach Post article that I hope people have the chance to read, which is called Why is the Obama Administration So Confident? I think I'm the only National Democratic strategist that said this court will vote 5-4 against. Because this is a case where you have rich guys in robes with federal health insurance themselves who have no clue about poor and average people who need many wouldn't have adequate health insurance without the bill. It took generations for Congress to pass. And it's really tragic, Bob. And I really am sad that that's what American justice has come to, is you have four justices who will vote in favor of the American people and five who go Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, injecting money back into politics and now take away health care from the people that was duly and legitimately voted by the Congress.
And they're not just five Supreme Court justices. These are the very kinds of justices that the right wing talk about when they say activist judges legislating from the bench. Congress has certain powers, and they're supposed to, the rules of construction say that they're supposed to afford significant deference to the power of Congress unless it's proven to be abusive or arbitrary and capricious, that kind of standard of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But these five, they have an ideology that trumps constitutional interpretation, constitutional construction, equal justice concepts. All of that is trumped by the fact that they are owned. You know, the fact that Justice Thomas is even still participating in this thing drives me crazy, Bob.
Awful. With his wife getting money and saying that she's an ambassador to the Tea Party, getting money from the opposition to the bill, and yet the Supreme Court recuses themselves from judicial ethics that every other court in America has to have, that says you can't do exactly that.
Right.
But, you know, you mentioned activism and power to the people. With the Republicans and the right-wing court, that's unless it's activism that gives the American people their own power that they don't want to give them, and unless it takes the power away that they want to take away. Take a look at what happened in Bob McDonald's Virginia and Rick Perry's Texas. Forced transvaginal ultrasound probes inside women's bodies, which the World Health Organization defines putting a probe in a woman's body as rape.
Yes.
That is the world definition of rape. And then the Doonesbury final column, which right-wing censors wanted to take away from some people, says, and the final indignity, now here's your bill. They are making women pay for this rape that they didn't want themselves. And then you have the governor of Tennessee who says, well, they cannot look at it when it's thrown into their faces with the sonogram on the screen. What an outrage. That's their idea of no mandate. That is a horrible mandate, and that's what they want to do for health care. But they don't want people to have the right to have health care. To them, that's a mandate. But it's not a mandate when you push a probe into a woman's body.
You know, I saw they were over there. I went walking around in the zoo before the program started. I like to see those people. They're so strange. And the guy standing up there that says, health care does not exist in nature. It is not a natural right.
Yeah, you know what the lifespan was when I was a kid and my grandfather, I was looking up to him for old age? 20 years less than it is now. When I was a kid, the lifespan was 56 for men. It is now 76 for men and 80 for women. There are three reasons for it. One is health care and medicine. The other is nutrition. We've learned that you don't eat fats and you don't eat butter and you don't drink whole milk. You try to do less stuff, you know, skim milk and margarine, and all. And the third, and chicken and fish and less red meat. And the third is physical fitness. We've learned that you have to go to a gym every other day for a half hour, and that actually, the Washington Post says, adds 9 years to your life in their study of all the studies. So health care should be a right, not a privilege. And yet,
because it's the right. Wait a minute, this is one of theirs, isn't it? Isn't it the right to life, Bob?
There you go. But the right to life doesn't exist if it's a good benefit for people. It only exists if you want to take something from people.
Right,
then it's a right to life.
The right to life doesn't exist if you're outside the womb.
Yeah.
If you're, yeah.
The hypocrisy of the right wing is astounding, that they can be right to life but no health care, no benefits. Take away food stamps, which is what they're doing in their budget. Take away education, which adds life and quality of life to you. Take away those things and spend the money and give the tax breaks to rich people. To them, that's what the rights of America should be. And it's really an incredible difference in philosophy. So, you know, one thing you can say politically, if this case goes down, the American people could go into outrage. The Republicans may not realize it, but before they put in their propagandizing and their hundreds of millions of dollars of publicity, before every time there is a health care bill, the American people support by a 15-point majority health care for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So if this bill goes down, we're going to swing back to an overwhelming desire by the American people for health care. And it's just outrageous that that they have bought their way into opposing this bill and even persuading the Supreme Court to do it.
But, Bob, you message on this stuff so very well. I mean, you are one of the true pros out there. But our side doesn't have that many.
Terrible.
The right wing is going to be ready in either outcome, regardless of what the outcome is. If they were to uphold the Affordable Care Act, the right wing would be ready to start a scorched earth war that'll last 40 years, just like the war has over Roe versus Wade, which will be 40 years old next year.
Right.
And if they should happen to win and the ACA be stricken down, then the right wing is also going to be ready to defend against any efforts by Democrats and progressives to make those miserable bastards pay.
You're so right, Bob. Clooney was on TV on all the cables saying the Democrats have a terrible message machine. The Republicans have a killer closed message machine. Why can't the Democrats have it? And I don't know the answer, because under Bill Clinton, we did. We had Rahm, we had Begala, we had Carville. Those were aggressive, forceful people. I was proud to be part of that team. I was on the White House press staff during that team. And I learned from them that you've got to go for it, and you got to go for it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, A, B, C, D, E.
Right, and you don't let them get away with nothing.
Here's what I found. When I was on, I sneaked onto being a regular on Fox and Friends in the morning as the token House progressive Democrat, so I get my say here and there. But they still try to play, and they try to cut me off. So I was ticking off the provisions of the health bill a few months ago, and I was going, children's care through 26, and cheaper and free drugs for seniors, pre-existing conditions coverage, and suddenly they're cutting me off and saying, we don't want to talk about the bill, we want to talk about the title of the bill. Isn't it a killer bill? No, it's not a killer bill. It's, and then I go back into it. I said, no lifetime caps, not being thrown off of sick, free prevention, mammograms and colonoscopies, and 85% of the premiums have to go to benefits in healthcare, not oversight for the insurance companies and high salaries. So John Stewart picked up on Fox trying to cut me off, and he made a joke of it, and I got it up on my website, wienerpublic.com, by the way, to your listeners.
Yeah.
And Stewart said on The Daily Show, and he played my clip and being cut off, then he played, and then here he goes again, putting the list through again, and he said, Wiener, what part of we don't want our viewers to know what's in the bill don't you understand?
Yeah.
And that was his joke.
And
there's
yes,
a total truth to the Republicans trying to stop that. When I was on an airplane before I went on Fox, I was, you know, I role-play wherever I am. I was role-playing, you know, I'm desperate. I'm role-playing to the flight attendant, right?
Yeah.
About what I'm going to say. And he says, you know, I don't like the bill. And I said, you know, it's got children's care through 26, cheaper drugs for seniors, pre-existing conditions covered, no lifetime caps, not being thrown off if sick, free mammograms and colonoscopies, and 85% has to go to benefits to people. And he said, gee, if I knew all that's in the bill, that's a good bill. And that's your flight attendant on the airplane before I go on TV. So, and by the way, Bob is knocking his head on the mic for our listeners who don't
they're used to it. So,
That's the deal, is the Republicans don't want people to know what's in the bill.
I have been getting, and granted, I mean, Families USA has done a magnificent job pulling this radio row together, and the other affiliated organizations have brought folks in here, and they've had a profound presence out in front of the Supreme Court. And yet,
well, I'll tell you, this profound presence. Let's be honest with our listeners. There's 200 people out there. Do you really
think? I thought
that
was more than 200.
Do you really? I just walked right by it.
Okay.
Do you really think that 200 people that the justices know are going to be pro and they're going to be against, and their stage demonstrations are really going to impact them? I wish it were true, but it's not going to happen.
I'm not concerned with. I don't think the justices consider much of that one way or the other, so much as it is a representation to the rest of the people that there is support for the bill. And frankly, the right wing message.
And they got the right wing has their 50 people saying no health care now, no health. So
the other thing for two months now, Bob. For some reason or other, I get right-wing emails. I don't know why, but you know, some people get up in the morning and they read the comics. I get up and I read right-wing press releases. For 2 months, I've been getting press releases from the right-wing telling me that, and then I got it right here, thousands of people will descend on Washington, D.C. on March
thousands.
The 27th. And
there are more people in Radio Row right here with you and me than there are out on the...
Well, but the thing is, if you go down, and I did, if you go down to Senate Park South, down past the Russell Senate Office Building, that's where they were gathering.
Oh, okay.
They've got, you know, one of the portable stages. They've got their little portable Klieg lights
up.
They've got a media riser. There's 8 cameras there. They've coordinated coverage. I mean, they've done everything
right.
they need to do. On the other hand,
we got nothing. Yeah.
Well, no, we don't. We don't have nothing. This is not nothing.
No, here you're talking about Radio
but
Row.
I'm talking about outside.
I've noticed, and I want to be straight about this one too. Radio Row has enormous power.
Yes.
I remember when the bill was coming up, and we got to do the same thing again. When the bill was coming up, you and I made the point that this is nonsense that the Senate says it has to go to 60, and we said call Reid. Rahm was the chief of staff to the White House,
yeah.
And Reid is the Senate leader, and we said call them, and we gave their phone numbers and tell them we don't want 60, we want the Constitution allows under, what's it called, sequestration or whatever the term
mm-hmm.
was at the time, and the Constitution allows a vote with 50, not 60, and so we can get a vote on the bill. We got it a week later, Reid reversed and Rahm reversed and said we're going to allow the 50 votes instead of the 60 and call it part of the... We actually won that and got the health care bill because of the power of Radio Row.
And
we've got to do that again here now.
That's why this is so important, what goes on here, because the other thing, having been coming to these Radio Rows for a while now,
right.
Bob, I'm seeing more and more and varied people and new faces. We don't have near the power that right-wing radio has because we don't have nearly the support.
But if we laser focus and target what we do...
But it's growing, and the ability to focus is growing as well.
Don't forget that Ed Schultz started from Radio Row kinds of things.
Yeah.
And he's a big... And Rachel and all of that. So we got our say now a little bit.
Right, and that's what...
Except that Fox tops CNN and MSNBC combined. So,
well, there's another statistic out there. I don't know if you're aware of or not, but it's the one that drives me crazy. It sends me running screaming into the night. And it remains true that for every hour of progressive radio there is in this country, there are 1,000 hours of right-wing hate.
Yeah.
1,000 to 1.
But they put their feet in their mouth, like Rush has done. So that helps.
Well, and it does help. But by the same token, he diverts from other messaging. You know, because I've got a very smart audience, and they were okay, Bob. Not one more night talking about Rush. Not one more, Bob.
Okay.
And so I didn't. And I need reminders like that from time to time that there are other things out there.
Yeah.
Hey,
how about
Dick Cheney's heart transplant?
But they forgot to connect it to his brain.
I think they connect. Never mind.
How about the Zimmerman case on the Trayvon Martin thing?
Right, and that's the thing I was concerned with.
I can't believe that the media is allowing Zimmerman's lawyer now to say he was really attacked. He was the aggressor. Haven't they listened to the tape and realized the kid was running for his life, running away, trying to get back to his gated community where he was a little protected, and then the guy running after him, pursuing him, which the police said not to do. So of course he defended himself and scrapped and clawed. I haven't heard that side of it yet, and I don't understand the lawyers not making that point that the kid was defending himself. He should be the one that sues under the stand your ground law, this idiot who was pursuing him.
But
how do you do self-defense when you're the one chasing the guy and kill him?
Right,
how
exactly.
is that self-defense?
Right, but you're asking the for-profit 1% media to do things the for-profit 1% media are not capable of doing, Bob.
I just hope that they see through the truth on that one and that there is an arrest and a prosecution
and we got
a grand jury.
You really want that? You really want that kind of incisive question? You really think that kind of incisive questioning is going to come from Joe Scarborough?
I'm listening to it from Chris Matthews, who thinks he has to be fair and let this other lawyer have his say without asking the challenging question of, wasn't the kid running for his life, so of course he scraped and clawed against Zimmerman? He never asked the question.
Oh, Chris is afraid somebody's going to call him a liberal.
I mean, if Zimmerman didn't have a little blood on his head and a broken nose, I'd say, what was this kid up to?
Well, hell, he shot him point blank.
That's my
point. He's got his blood on him.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, see, the point that I've been making, and I'm proud to see that others have, because it's much more a point that needs to be made by others than by me, is that there is a very bright line that extends from Emmett Till in 1955 to Trayvon Martin in 2012. There really, really is. And even the stuff that Chris Hayes.
You started out when I thought we were off the air talking about slavery, you know?
Yeah, no. But Chris Hayes had a thing. I guess the FBI is working to recover some audio. Trayvon Martin may have made his own 911 call. Holy cow.
Well, that would be useful.
Yeah. And it would be huge because
if the police didn't destroy it.
Yeah. So, you know, that's waiting to come. But I tell you what. Every time I look forward to these trips to D.C. and these radio rows, Bob, because I always hope that I have a chance to have a conversation with you.
This was
because
great.
Because you are wired up. You know what the hell's going on, and you have the dry passion to scream it from the rooftops. And I like using
the fact that I've had the blessing of having worked on the Hill and in the White House, and then I can bring that into the issues that we all care about in our direction.
How did you get into the Clinton White House? I've never heard that story.
We lost the Congress. And when I was working for John Conyers, we lost the Congress. And the Clinton White House asked me to come in because, remember Clinton's drug policy was I didn't inhale?
Yes.
Well, they didn't think that was really a drug policy. That there was education, prevention, rehabilitation, treatment, as well as law enforcement and foreign policy. There actually was a drug strategy. So he was getting creamed on that issue. So I talked to Mike McCurry, who was Clinton's press secretary, and I talked to Rahm, and they said, we've got to have you here to help us with this and to get the message out that there's actually a drug policy. So I went in as the drug policy spokesman under four-star General Barry McCaffrey.
Okay. Well, that's it. Obviously, from that point to this, you have never slowed down and you have never let up. And I hope you don't.
Well, you remember while I was there, then we expanded a little because I was harassed by Ken Starr. Do you remember that story?
Yes, absolutely.
And he subpoenaed my wife and me. She saw her friends on TV putting out a press release saying Trips tapes were illegal of Lewinsky. And so we called them up to congratulate them for their press release on TV. And Starr thought it was some White House conspiracy and subpoenaed me as obstructing Clinton's case. So I went out. I let him subpoena me. I went into the courthouse and said, this is Big Brother at its worst. And we made the lead of Brokaw and Jennings. and we were interviewed on Today and Good Morning America with that message, and Starr fell from popularity and Clinton became the victim. So we've had some fun in the stuff we've done.
Well, and it doesn't surprise me in the least that that would be something that that you would do, because
I was very proud of that one. The New York Times said that I would, just to, I mean, if I can just say this humbly, New York Times said I was the first witness in the grand jury case that Starr had that went out in the courthouse steps and challenged him for overreach. The New York Times credited me for that, so I try not to be bashful.
Well, you shouldn't be. You know, I can't hear the name Ken Starr, Bob, without thinking, well, there's $70 million we'll never get back.
Correct. And 7 years, and it's like the Chinese fortune cookie. You had to say about sex to any of those charges that he threw out there.
Right.
Obstruction and whatever else. Look, your listeners are going to hate me for this. But half the guys in America would have done the same thing. They're not going to go they're not going to go advertising that they had an affair, because half marriages end in divorce.
I said that while it was happening. I mean,
it's actually the honorable thing to do, to not talk about an affair if you have one.
Yes, this is my 16-year-old son, Bob, and we've had that conversation. Gentlemen, do not
tell.
Yes, and tell.
Yeah. So that's what Ken Starr. With the flaw I give on that one. Reno should not have empowered Starr to go after that sexual piece of the investigation. When Starr came to him and to her and said, can I have the additional power, she should have said no. I do fault Reno for giving him that power.
Well, see, I remember when Carville wrote the book and the horse he rode in on.
You know, I was in that book as a whole chapter, I just described you.
I know. And but he, you know, he also describes the whole thing whereby, who was it, Centel?
Yes.
That empowered Starr in the first place.
Right.
Yeah, it was not a comedy, but a tragedy of errors from the beginning. From well-meaning people like Janet Reno, who never should have. Bob Wiener, it is always
a pleasure
to talk to you, my friend, and I look forward to the next time I get to sit down to a conversation.
Great.
Take care.
Sorry I babbled after you wanted to be done earlier.
Oh, no, I didn't want to be done earlier. I was fine. It's always an adventure keeping up with your schedule in one of these things, because it becomes fluid and it runs, you know.
This is great. We want to make sure we get a copy of this.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. All right. Let me have a card, and I'll clip this out, and I'll make sure that you get it. All right, take care, Bob. Thanks. Bob Wiener of Robert Wiener Associates, Wiener Public, Wiener public.com. And you know what that does? That brings us to the, you know, this is where we would cue up High Flight. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and chased the shouting winds along. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've climbed the windswept heights with easy grace where never lark nor even eagle flew. And with silent, lifting mind, I've reached out my hand and touched the face of God.
That's all, folks.
That's what you don't remember when TV stations signed off. You don't even know what that means.
No, I don't.
But that was done, you know, it shows the pilot getting into his fighter bomber aircraft that you would use to, like, bomb brown people into oblivion. And it's this poem about touching God. But, you know, he's at 50,000 feet, and he's reaching out his hand and touching the face of God. Do you know what would happen if he reached out his hand and touched the face of God?
He'd been ripped off in prison.
It'd land in the Sea of Marmara. That's the kind of silliness you deal with. But it is. It's time to quit. It's time to start packing up. Packing up and loading out is going to be a booger, because we can't get anywhere near here.
They've got the Capitol blocked off.
Yeah, I know. Now we have to go out and reconnoiter which way we have to hike. We are parked a million miles away at Union Station.
I knew the way to get around this.
You've been doing your work. The voice you're hearing now is, of course, Ferg.
Hello, folks.
Who deserves... No voices.
No, folks. No, no.
No voices, thank you.
All right. All then. Right. Yes, Miss Daisy.
No, stop it. Who, as reward and recompense for his hard work in this broadcast day, gets to say a couple of words, which he just did in saying, that's all, folks.
Thank you.
So with that being the case, and it being 4 minutes or so, 3 minutes or so, until 3 p.m., that gets us pretty close to three solid hours of broadcasting, minus a few profound gaps that Agnes might kindly remove from the record. I will say that I hope you enjoyed the conversations we had here at Radio Row. I want to extend a special thanks to our hosts here in the United Methodist Building, the United Methodists, and extend thanks particularly to our dear friends at Families USA, who do understand the value of progressive messaging and walk the walk and talk the talk. There is a lot of hard work that goes into all this. Folks like Dave Lemon and my buddy Arian and Candy Stroud, who pulls the Radio Row together. Thanks to all of them. And thanks to you for joining in and listening. I hope you have gotten value out of this. I hope maybe some of these things about the Affordable Care Act have been cleared up, and that you understand that it's not all, you know, that it's not all bad.
There's hope.
There's a lot of it that's good. A great deal of it that is good. So with that, we will sign off and thank you. And the next time you hear our voices will probably be, as far as live broadcast, either Thursday night or Friday night, depending on when we arrive back in the studio at the mansion in West Virginia.
Charlie Bucket Mansion.
Shut up. It is not our Charlie Bucket house. Stop that. That's your home.
I love my home.
I know.
I just don't love the environment.
I don't like it when it rains in the bedroom on your mother either, but it is what it is. Now, the next time you hear from us, it'll probably be either Thursday night or Friday night, because we're going to do a little bit more work with the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign while we are here, that maximizing two birds, stones, something about rocks. So I'll thank you all very kindly, wish you well, and look forward to talking to you when we talk to you, which will probably be Thursday or Friday. Until then, take care, and thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen, from you who kindly contribute to keep the program on the air, to your contribution of your thoughts, your ideas, your emails, your phone calls. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You know, you can go to crmw.net. You can order the coolest T-shirt in America, the Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt. You can sign up for the email newsletter. And you can even give a contribution. You can be part, therefore, of the struggle for basic human rights in Appalachia. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch. And I've been doing my own bit of advocacy here to try to make folks aware of the human rights crisis, the Appalachian apocalypse. I never go anywhere that I don't do a little bit of missionary work. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk soon. Bye now.
Bye.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I'm here. Let the bells ring out, the banners fly. It's too good to be true, but I'm here. You hold a feast your ears on me. That's for my old cartoon. Hi, I'm Bob. I'm so damn happy to be back in my own studio. I don't know quite what to do. It is Friday on the front porch. It has been a very long week. 2 days there at the Supreme Court. It had been a long time since I'd seen that many fundies and right-wingers and teabaggers. And I don't know if I'd ever seen that many of them in one place. Whew. Moses. It's the kind of, I mean, there was a miasma of stupid in the air out there in front of the Supreme Court a couple of times. I mean, there's a lot of good people there, too. Stupid's thick like gravy, you know, bad lumpy gravy. And we, Berg and I, saw more than our fair share of it. I'm tired. It has been a whale of a week. You know, we did our thing there at the Supreme Court, kindly hosted by our dear friends at Families USA, who provided us fascinating people to talk to, learn from. Then, after that was over, my colleague Bo Webb and I did some work on Capitol Hill trying to build awareness of the the war that's being waged against hillbillies here in Appalachia. And I think we're doing amazing work, good work. But I would be kidding you if I said that it wasn't tough. It's tough and it's tiresome. And these trips are bookended by long drives. I got in just a little bit ago. I've been sort of jotting notes all mentally and voice notes and so forth like that all along the way about what I wanted to bring to the fore when we got back. What is this with me and we? Well, it's Ferg and me is what it boils down to. But when I got back to the microphone, I wanted to give you an idea of, there was some stuff that was on my mind that I felt like deserved some conversational time. And then while I'm driving home, everything changes. Every time I set out to be all nice and responsible and plot out an engaging 3 hours of radio, some right-wing jackass goes and just throws it all into chaos. Rick Santorum is the culprit today. But before we get there, just a little more of an overview of what we did. We've been working, Bo and I have been, and Ferg, who is turning into a fine advocate in his own right. And as Dr. John said on Tuesday, when Ferg went out to try to carry on sane conversations, a little spot reporting, as Dr. John referred to it, with teabaggers. Ferg came back into the broadcast area. I mean, his eyes were like coffee saucers. Now, Ferg has been known to sit down and play his fair share of zombie games. Our good buddy, Brother Albert, the sage of Southwest Wisconsin, sort of put him on to zombie games. And Ferg enjoys them. But when I muted the mic for a minute because I hadn't seen that face on him in a long time. He said, "Dad, it's weird out there. It's really weird out there." And it was. It was. I mentioned this one goober that I got a photo of. The guy who, for the life of me, was just everybody. All the birthers were out in force. And some of them were captured photographically. But the guy that Ferg came to refer to as Snapple Guy really is baffling. He's standing there holding a handwritten poster that says, "Canada has national health care. It has a short growing season and cannot grow much food." Truly a message for the generation. Then, and I tweeted some of these photos. Then there was the lady, apparently Americans for Prosperity, or Americans effing people, the right-wing group that fronts all this astroturfery, these teabaggers,
had their spell check brigade out. Obamacare is unconstitutional. And we'll let it slip that the N in unconstitutional looks a little bit like uncalstitutional. Uphold our freedom and our freedom, liberty, and rights. No socialism. Remember 10th Amendment. Only the word remember is an addition that has been written on white copy paper and taped over probably what is R-E-M-B-E-R, remember, 10th Amendment. There were lots of them. Stop Obama's subversion of the Constitution. No Obamarks care or Cloward and Piven spending. Justices, Judge Obamacare from the bench on this side of the Atlantic. Well, Barack Obama the dictator is not eligible to be president, i.e. his Social Security card, Selective Service card, birth certificate, all are forged. Like that. Yeah, I think Ferg got an education this week. But that was just Monday and Tuesday. We moved into the realms of advocacy for Appalachian communities on Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday, for instance, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to make sure that we were in D.C. early, taking the Vienna train all the way into D.C. Long ride, long train ride. And doing some talking and handshaking and explaining and hopefully a little bit of teaching. And when we got where we stayed on, we stayed all the way out in Manassas Wednesday and Thursday nights, because Manassas is a good 25 miles from the first metro station you come to, which is Vienna Fairfax. And so hotels are a little less expensive. And we stayed there Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. And when we got there Tuesday night, I was outside taking in the pleasant night air. All of D.C. was simply a burst in color of various and sundry blooming trees, flowering crabapples and flowering pears and the like. It was, in fact, a veritable pollen party. People walking around D.C. going like they'd just gotten out of Studio 54 30 years ago. And I'm standing outside when I see this guy who has a whole tribe of kids. And he's trying to deal with them, and I feel some sympathy for him because I remember when ours were that little, and shoot, they're not that easy to travel with now that they're teenagers. Some would say it's even more complicated. But he was, you know, those little piston thingies that hold up your hatchback or your hood or whatever. Well, he was trying to get stuff out of the back of his monumental SUV people transporter, Florida plates. And it kept dropping as he was trying to haul stuff out. Meanwhile, he had a little toddler kind of grabbing him by the leg. Daddy, Daddy. So I said, hey, let me help you here. And I held the thing up for him while he got his stuff out. I'm that way. And it turned, hey, buddy, hey, you know, and then hi, and, you know, I'm Bob, and I'm Vince, and talking about driving around D.C. and blah, 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 and where to park, and, you know, they were going to go and do the sites and the memorials and the monuments and everything the next day. Okay, no big deal. All right. So I see him, I guess, Thursday morning, and he tells me how they had no trouble, and thanks for the help, the advice getting him around D.C., blah, 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 blah. And then this morning, I see him again. And this morning, all of a sudden, that hotel is awash in people carrying Bibles. And they, and you know, it's one of those motels where you get a free continental breakfast. You know, they've got a bunch of frozen microwavable pancakes and frozen microwavable turkey sausage and frozen microwavable gravy. And they put that out for breakfast. And, you know, I was grateful for it. You know, a little something to get the day going. And I'm headed, you know, we're heading out. And now he's surrounded by all these people with Bibles. And I felt like I was in a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Think quick, Reddit. But he, so he says, oh, we're here for a Bible study weekend. And I thought, oh, no. No, please, God, let this cup pass from before me. And he asked me what it is I do. Prudently, I told him we were there to work on saving our communities from what he says. And I explained to him what mountaintop removal is. You know, I'll always, it's one of those parts of being a recovering Southern Baptist that you never get over the notion that you need to witness. Got to do some witnessing. Got to testify a little bit. Yeah. So I explained to him what mountaintop removal was. And he said, brother, we're all here for Bible study. You know, our only common thread is that we all hate organized religion. I'm like, well, I'm right there with you, buddy. Didn't tell him the rest of it, but. And so he says, well, I think we need a moment of prayer. We need to put this in the hands of the Lord. I'm standing there. I'm just standing there with a cup of melted brown crayon and hot water flavored decaf coffee and a plate of eggs with some Texas Pete over it, you know, to give them a little life, and a couple of turkey sausage patties. And it really is not conducive to me doing the whole, gotta go now, hear my mother calling, you know, gotta do my hair. So before, lickety split, there's that hand on my, one hand on my shoulder, another hand up in the air, and Lord Jesus, Bob and Vince, and we just come together, Lord Jesus, to ask you to help save his community and save it, and save his mountain, Lord, hallelujah, amen. It went on for a little longer than that, really. And then it was nice knowing you. Glad you got around D.C. okay. Gotta go now. Well, if you're going to be here, you're welcome to sit in. I mean, we don't charge fee or anything. You're welcome to sit in on our Bible study. No. Gotta get back to the hills. They may be blowing up the home by the time I get there. Gotta get back to the hills. Thank you, though. Thank you very kindly. And off did I sprint. So he tells me the name of their ministry. And I guess it's sort of the unaffiliated, non-denominational, whatever. But I can't help going and looking when I hear these things. And it's, at first I thought he said he came from Joe's Stone Crab and he had the Florida plate. So okay, hey man, good eats, man. Maybe he's a chef. No, he's with Stone Kingdom Ministries. And so we get out of there and we get our bags out to the car and Ferg's in the co-pilot seat there. Jesus, take the wheel. And once we're out of the main D.C.-ish kind of traffic and we've got our happy little right lane thing going and the cruise control's engaged and we're toddling along, say, hey, Ferg. Yeah, Dad. Take the phone there and open up the browser. This is one of those moments when the technology's kind of fun, really. Take the phone there and open up the browser and look up Stone Kingdom Ministries. I'll bet you it's stonekingdom.org or stonekingdomministries.org. Okay, Dad. Yep, the Google's got it, Dad. Well, click on that. Let's learn a little bit about our buddies there. Sometimes I wish I didn't do that sort of thing. Sometimes I feel like I just need to stay home, and if the work wasn't so damned important, I would. What you were about to hear, I am not making up. Now, bear in mind that I took no small amount of my time to sit here and tell this dude, with whom I had developed a passing, you know, acquaintance there in the hall, in the hallways, in the foyer of the hotel, and, hey, good trip. Yeah, I saw the zoo. Oh, the zoo's fun. Cherry blossoms are beautiful. Yeah. And then so I sat there, and I should have got, you know, there was a clue.
Just a minute there, ma'am. I think we got a clue here.
There was a clue, because I tell him about everything that's going on. He says, well, you know, I hate Obama. This from a Christian. I hate Obama. But his EPA is supposed to be helping with things like that, aren't they? I said, man, that wasn't hateful. Doing missionary work, not trying to put people off the issue. Got it. Got to have a big tent. Got to bring everybody in. Got to be inclusive. You know, because I'm liberal like that, progressive. And, you know. And I said, let me tell you something. Barack Obama is no more of a liberal than I am the Holy Roman Emperor. And I got to tell you, he shuddered a little bit at the phrase Holy Roman Emperor. I said, he's center to center right, and while his EPA has done a few things to help us, they did stop one big old mountaintop removal operation, but one of his own appointed judges just overturned that veto last week and said, nah, blow them up, boys! Which is what she did. If you go over and look at WVGazette.com in today's op-ed section, you'll notice an op-ed penned by my friend and my colleague, Bo Webb, about exactly that. It pretty much captures the essence of the situation. But I sat there and explained to him that no, the EPA wasn't doing that much for us. They certainly hadn't stopped mountaintop removal. I explained to him, you know, that they take down thousands of acres and hundreds of feet of mountain for a seam of coal that's 12 to 18 inches thick, and that the poison gets into our babies and into our babies in the womb and into women's wombs and into our lungs and our hearts and our genitourinary systems. And I didn't know if you could say genitourinary to an evangelical, but I was willing to take the risk for the issue, for the movement. And he said, well, there's plenty of coal in other places. Why are they still doing that? I said, because it is profitable. And trying to speak the language a little bit, I said, for their God is mammon. And we are the sacrifices on that altar. Hand goes up a little bit, you know, we pray. It's kind of like twinkle fingers in the Occupy movement. And Fundy's put the little hand up. Jesus, yes. So that's all the stuff that's swirling around in my mind as Ferg opens up StoneKingdom.org. StoneKingdom.org.
I said, well, just read to me what's on the home page, son. And he says, well, here it is, Manassas IV. I said, that's a Roman numeral, son. There's no intravenous going on in Manassas 4, Spring 2012 Bible Conference. That's what we've been watching. He said, and there's something here that says, danger of root canals, acid reflux, invisibility cloaks hit the big time. Government and jobs. EPA gets caught in a big fat lie. I said, stop right there. Read me that one. Ferg's done run off with his mama to the grocery store, so I can't have him read it to me or read it to us. So you'll have to just pretend that I'm Ferg for a minute. And he reads the following. The notion that the Environmental Protection Agency uses, quote, quotation marks, science, close quotes, to justify their regulations is false. Just like most of the claims they issue on various aspects of the nation's environment. Their favorite scam is to estimate the number of deaths they will prevent with some new draconian regulation. The EPA is the American equivalent of the Gestapo, a ruthless enforcement agency with a very green agenda. Really? The Gestapo was green? Who knew? I thought they wore black. Very green agenda that is opposed to the use of many beneficial chemicals, every form of energy, everyone, and the right of people to be left alone. Dad, it says it continues here. You want me to read? You want me to keep going? Oh, read on, McDuff, says I. At the top of its list of priorities is the destruction of the nation's economy with special attention to all forms of energy production. Manufacturing anything comes next, followed by afflicting the nation's vast agricultural sector. The EPA insists that dust is a pollutant. You can't farm without generating dust. Can't mountaintop or move without generating it either. And it's full of this really nifty, terrifying crap called P as in Paul, A as in Andy, H as in hellfire, PAH toxins, which stands for polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are, it turns out, partially combusted hydrocarbons that go up in the air and then come down, and they're itsy-bitsy, teensy-bitsy, and they're so teeny-tiny that there's nothing inside the human body that can filter them or stop them. Or it ain't like pollen where, you know, you look like Studio 54, like I was talking about a couple of minutes. No, and it accumulates in your body. And then you go to the doctor one day, and they say, we've got to have a serious conversation. You say, about what? And they say, about that cancer. Go on, boy. To understand the threat the EPA poses, it is necessary to understand that proposed clean air regulations are based on the claim that global warming is real, is happening, and is caused primarily by carbon dioxide. The claim is utterly without any scientific merit. There is no global warming, at least not the kind Al Gore lies about. The North and South Poles are not melting. They gain and lose ice in a perfectly natural cycle that has been going on for billions of years. The polar bears are not disappearing. Drilling for oil in Anwar will have zero effect on the caribou, etc. With our vast reserves of coal and natural gas, the U.S. does not lack for the ability to generate electricity or to refine oil for transportation. If you want to stay warm this winter, you better hope that utilities keep producing the electricity for your home or apartment's heating system. 50% of that electricity is produced by cheap, abundant coal. And cheap. Because, you know, my kids' lives, my life, my wife's life, my friends' lives, my whole entire community, my region's lives. It's cheap, I tell you, cheap. You want to buy a watch? Me, I've been trying to figure out what it is that the creator of the universe was trying to get across to me with this whole little thing. Except maybe to tell me that I needed to go home and have some sacramental rum and with maybe a little sacramental Coca-Cola and a sacramental lime or maybe even a sacramental mint leaf. Relax for a little bit, sacramentally. Or even in Sacramento. Whatever. That's the and all because I hit the. You know, down in the basement of the Baptist church, the little old blue-haired lady said, "Help your neighbor." So here's a guy who's struggling to get, who's apparently got six. It turned out seven children, and he's trying to get all of their crap out of a car that looked like the and the back of his car looked like the interior of Fibber McGee's closet. There's a reference you'll have to go to the Google for. And I just hold the damn thing up, trying to be the decent neighbor the little old blue-haired ladies in the basement of the Baptist church tried to teach me to be. Because it never struck me that it's a bad idea. But now I am beginning to wonder. Oh, I just got a photograph from our buddy Isaac. Of a mashed up front end of an automobile, and the front bumper tag says, "God is my co-pilot." Subject line on Isaac's email. Any questions? See? I don't go courting this. Oh, by the way, update. We had another screw-up McDonald's smoothie. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. There wasn't nearly as much drama involved. Honey, for some reason or another, we're out of the yogurt part of our smoothie, so your smoothie don't have no yogurt in it, but it's just as good anyway, trust me. The smoothie whisperer was not going to try to solve this one. We got back in the car quickly. Oh. And by the way, I should tell you that next week looks positively ordinary. And probably the week after that. There's a great deal of likelihood we'll be back in D.C. sometime around the... I'll probably have to leave here on the 15th of April for some doings there. I'm getting to where I can actually drive in D.C. traffic. I'm proud. But, by the way, you know, this Stone Kingdom Ministries webpage... Of course, they're hustling gold. And I should mention to you that while he was laying hands on me and praying, he prayed for prosperity, that Jesus might make us prosperous no matter what happened. Just saying. Let's see, they're hustling therapeutic essential oils. Good Life International, LLC, Preservation of Wealth, Sportron, somebody's letter that tells people to put lemon juice on everything they eat and they won't have to take no purple pill. No more Breyers ice cream for me. The cancer time bomb sitting in your refrigerator. Will you stop consuming it? Breast cancer conference. One food you may be surprised to learn directly linked to breast cancer. Pasteurized dairy in the form of milk or milk products. Oh, Margaret. This one was a dandy. Professor Snape, beware, invisibility cloaks aren't just for the microscopic anymore. Using natural crystals, two independent research teams have designed carpet cloaks that can abracadabra 3D objects as big as an ant or a grain of sand seemingly into nothing. No, really. Consider this event from the life of Jesus, but he passing through the midst of them went his way. Luke 4:30. I've often wondered exactly how Jesus was able to pass through the midst of a crowd. Ferg is reading this as we're going down the road, and he looks at me, he takes a break, and goes, by running? Who were trying to kill him? One possibility that occurred to me is, did Jesus use his supernatural power? Did Jesus use his supernatural power to make himself invisible? I don't think so. I think he used the Jedi mind trick. Jedi Jesus. I am not the Savior you're looking for. Hail Caesar, you're not the Savior we're looking for. If he did, I do not contend that he needed to use something as crude as a technological device, but it is interesting that science seems to be on the verge of such a device. I won't bother you anymore with this. Well, there's the research department. Our buddy Bill. Hey, Bill, by the way, I got word for you. My pal Bo, with whom I've been traveling, is an old Cleveland guy. I said, you ever heard of Mr. Stress? And he goes, oh, man, he's awesome! So, you are known. Ron and Raleigh writing, Bob. Remember, no good deed goes unpunished, especially when dealing with evangelicals. P.S. No Google needed. I used to watch Fibber McGee and Molly on the little Emerson TV with the rounded sides when I was a little kid, 1959. See, that's even pre-me, but I had parents who talked about Fibber McGee's closet. Bill said I had to call my buddy Gildersleeve to explain what Fibber's closet meant. Yeah, it's nothing scary or anything. Patty writing in, by the way, she says, glad you're back and all's well. As for your stoner bros out there in the kingdom, that's K-I-N-G-D-U-M-B, they seem to be some type of conspiracy theory church, maybe. Just saying, like, as I was reading through, I saw quite a bit that reminds me of the good old Coke Sucker Brothers dad's organ, just saying. Like the letter from North Dakota stating they're building all the new homes in North Dakota with the heat that is run by the electric, because, really? BFNS. Love Patty, who's still scanning and a giggling. I needed the smile, thanks. And she follows up. Check out this. Well, let's see what it is. We'll just do this on the fly. Stone Kingdom Ministries. Ernestine Young. Let's see if we can find my buddy Vince. Because he was a preaching this weekend. Well, let's see what Ernestine Young has to say about the double portion, just to give you an idea of what I was dealing with.
Ernestine Young was born in Nampa, Idaho. She was instructed in the Kingdom Gospel by her mother and through reading many books by Dr. Howard Rand. How many of you are familiar with the works of Dr. Howard Rand?
Any kin to Ian?
Ernestine earned a B.A. of education and a master's degree in counseling and psychology at the University in British Columbia. She taught in the Vancouver area until 1979, at which time she returned to Idaho. When Frank Maldon resigned as pastor of the Church of the Covenant in Meridian, Idaho, Ernestine was asked to fill his position. She has faithfully done so for 31 years. Besides her ministerial and family responsibilities, she keeps busy in God's work, seeing to her tape mailings, traveling to various speaking engagements, and counseling many people who phone or write with questions, concerns, or problems. It is indeed an honor and a privilege to be acquainted with this dear and precious sister, Ernestine, and to receive instruction from her vast knowledge and understanding of the Scriptures. Ernestine Young.
Skip a bit, brother.
On the trip here, an airplane. I met a lady who, interestingly enough, was from Nampa, Idaho. Nampa's not the biggest place in Idaho, although it's bigger than it used to be. And she was into homeschooling. Five children have graduated, two more to go in her family. And she was telling me that this question about what role women have in...
Nope, ain't got the patience for what role women have. Sorry, can't go there. We'll use this for light entertainment later. Okay, that's a good turn of phrase, John. That's a terrific tale. Told well. Fundy tribbles, that's what they all are. Fundy tribbles. By the way, John sent a little something along earlier today. I looked down and he said, Bob, you might have noticed an odd contribution just now. Today's my birthday. Happy birthday, John. Today's my birthday, and it's a buck for every year. I'd like to encourage folks who haven't contributed this month to join the Thrifty 250. Really, you did some outstanding broadcasting from D.C. this week on a super important topic, and this is the kind of conversation